I'm going to be doing something this morning that's way ahead of time. I'm going to be playing for the first time on commercial radio, really any radio, parts of the new Cusco album, Apurimac 3, that I've been waiting and waiting and waiting for, and it's here, and oh my, is it good. So you will hear portions, no doubt, of that. It's a return to Native America, Apurimac 3, and let me tell you, it is something. All right, the beginning of Jim Keith's book says this stuff is black, black, black. That's a quote not of the author, but of Admiral Stansfield Turner, former director of the CIA. He said this stuff is black, black, black. And I wonder, Jim, was he referring to the men in black? When did he get a question, Jim, that, about the men in black that caused a retort of that sort?
In fact, it wasn't a reference to the men in black. It was a reference to black operations, undisclosed government operations that are funded covertly. Better that he would have been talking about the men in black, but unfortunately not.
Uh-huh. Well, I gave you my little scenario of what I thought the men in black might be. Last night I had Colonel Philip Corso on. And no matter what you believe about Philip Corso, it's hard to not be moved. And did you happen to hear the program?
In fact, I didn't.
You didn't? All right.
No.
He is a lieutenant colonel who was at the very highest levels of government, even in the White House, who has written a book called The Day After Roswell. It basically broken down, he received materials from Roswell and seeded them into American industry. It is an absolutely incredible story. And I'm talking, of course, about artifacts of an alien crash or several alien crashes. And, you know, I mean, here's a fellow who was in the very, very highest levels of government telling his story. The book is on the bestseller list. If you believe the colonel, who is 82 years old and has no reason to lie, and if you believe that, then a leap to believe that there are men who will come and take care of any evidence of this sort of thing before it gets public, well, that's easy to believe. Is that what the men in black are?
You know, Art, it's surprisingly close in terms of my viewpoint. I don't claim to be omniscient about this subject or anything, but one of the problems that people have in understanding all kinds of strange events is that they try to pigeonhole them in one category.
Right.
Whereas most of them have more than one source, and that applies to UFOs and angels, Bigfoot, and it includes the men in black. And For my true opinion about the men in black, I think that these encounters have at least four types. And those include the government, that has been trying to shut up witnesses since at least the early 50s. Much as UFO buffs don't like to hear it, I think there's delusion about this too. Some UFO buffs can be kind of paranoid.
Well, it's also a very easy way, Jim, to explain evidence you had, like the fish that got away. You know, I had this incredible evidence, you can weave a tale. And in the middle of the night, like thieves, the men in black came and took it.
Sure.
Here's my story. I wish I had the evidence, but the men in black have got it.
And I wish I had a dime for every time I've heard that story, too. You know, I mean, a lot of researchers lost their smoking gun about Roswell that way, you know.
Exactly.
But actually, there are hoaxers in the UFO community, and that includes many prominent UFO researchers. And then, in addition to that, surprising me as I did this research is that there's apparently a supernatural connection, that there really is a supernatural men in black, and that's a category that we seem to know a whole lot about, but at the same time cannot explain whatsoever. As far as the government having this kind of alien connection that has been fed into the technology and so forth, it's quite possible. But I always use this kind of Occam's razor thing. I have not seen any proof of that. I do believe that there are all kinds of advanced government programs and that there have been government aircraft that conform to the shape of flying saucers, but I've never seen that single bit of data or that one that got away that proves that these advanced technologies come from aliens.
Jim, what led you to even consider writing a book like this, which by its very title would, I would assume, to chronicle what history we know of the Men in Black, I mean, casebook after all. So what led you to be interested in this?
Boy, that's quite a question. I got interested in UFO and the occult at the age of 7. That was in 1957. And I believed every word that these wild, contactees like Adamski and Truman Bertram had to say about their flights to Venus and so forth. And I've continued to have an interest in the paranormal. Now, why I specifically dug into the Men in Black is really for the obvious reason. It's very interesting. And that's how I choose my next book at any given time, is what is piquing my own interest so that my research is really more like play than it is like doing a day job.
Now, there we connect. That's me, too. It's more like play than a job at all. So you just sort of became intrigued. Is the Men in Black a theory that rivals the black helicopter business going around now?
I think it rivals it in popularity, and since this new movie comes out, which seems, I have not seen it, but it seems like a glorified Ghostbusters, I think that the Men in Black is going to overtake the black helicopters in terms of people tossing these references about and so forth. As far as any connection, it is rather minimal. I know of one or two cases of black helicopters that have been connected to Men in Black, but that's out of literally hundreds of these black helicopters.
All right, so pretty much the Men in Black are a separate case.
I would say so.
All right, then let me start with what I probably should finish with, and that is you've studied it. You're way ahead of almost all of us in this area. The Men in Black, is it real? Are they real? Are there really Men in Black? What have you concluded?
Absolutely there are. But there are also fake Men in Black. You know, it's very interesting. I think the same thing is true of really any paranormal phenomenon. There are real instances of this, and there are fake ones. And, you know, my own belief is that the paranormal sometimes spurs the government to simulate these things to really twist people's minds.
Yes. I've frequently wondered about that.
Yeah.
Whether the government has an interest in promulgating the whole idea of the paranormal as a diversion of some sort. Who knows? You can weave all kinds of fantasy into what we're seeing. I do know that certain aspects of the paranormal occur. Manipulated? Real? I don't know yet. I think there is a real paranormal. I think there are really things that occur that we cannot explain. And as you point out, I think some are faked.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I believe this is really confirmed by CIA and FBI reports. Really at the beginning of people's interest in UFOs, right around late 1940s, early 1950s, where they talk about infiltrating groups of UFO aficionados and to investigate them because they may be up to subversive things. Now,
really?
Yeah. Now, going over literally hundreds of these Men in Black encounters, I've come to the conclusion that they involve copycatting, and that is that government men wear black suits, drive black cars, they simulate paranormality, and I think there's one reason for this.
What? Well, I've always wondered about that. I mean, you're right. They do wear black suits. They do drive in black cars. How come?
Well, let's say you have seen a UFO, or let's say that you research this material and are getting fairly close to an answer.
Okay.
A government man walks up to your door in a black suit with a black hat. Maybe he's got weird eyes. Maybe he's got long fingers, as many of these guys do. What it does is it scares the living daylights out of UFO observers.
Well, you make a good point. I mean, if your local government guy drove up in an orange car with a striped tie and some sort of loud sport jacket, you probably wouldn't take him nearly so seriously as mm-hmm. if he were dressed, as you point out, in black with a black hat and a big old black car. When you see something like that coming, you're going, oh,
yeah.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, it all seems pretty horrible, especially if they threaten you or threaten your family, and you're not sure if they're from another planet or not. I think it's a very effective way to shut UFO witnesses out.
Well, let me tell you, Jim, I've had visits from government agents, various alphabet-type organizations connected to the work that I do here, and they are... even though they seem easygoing and very nice guys, there is no question about it, Jim. I'm just talking about normal government agents here. In black suits, you know they're carrying, they've got a sort of a serious, we're here and you don't want to mess with this kind of attitude about them. And even though they're very nice, and very calm, there's no question about the fact that there is an aura of intimidation that you could cut with a knife.
You don't want to mess with these guys, even if they don't have these eyes that bug out of their head or a weird kaleidoscope unit that they train on your eyes. You know, I mean, yeah, you're saying they're intimidating enough.
I'm saying just regular government agency.
Even without some of the dramatizations that the men in black sometimes do, these guys are bad enough to fool with.
That's exactly right. So, I mean, encountering what you seem to be. Let's get down to it. I mean, casebook. There are some cases that you obviously believe are the best stories or the best evidence or might be genuine. What would they be?
Well, I don't know. There are many good cases. One of the most interesting one that always kind of sticks in my craw happened to a Dr. Hopkins in Maine in 1976.
Uh-huh.
And he had been hypnotically regressing an alleged UFO abductee. And he was met or contacted by a man in black who was bald, had dead white skin, and no lips. The lips were simulated with lipstick.
Oh.
Okay. This man in black discussed the UFO abduction case that the doctor was digging into in a monotone. He sounded like a robot. And then he apparently used ESP. He said, doctor, you have a dime and a penny in your pocket. The doctor reached in, and that's what he did have in his pocket. The man in the black told him to hold the penny in his open hand, and as the doctor looked at the penny, it turned silver, then blue, and then it slowly dematerialized. There was no chance for sleight of hand or legerdemain. The doctor was holding this and looking close while it slowly dematerialized.
Wow.
Now, this man in black asked Dr. Hopkins if he knew of another famous UFO abductee, actually Barney Hill.
Oh, yes.
He had recently died from a heart attack, and Hopkins responded that he did. And the man in black told him that it was no heart attack that had taken Barney Hill, but the same thing had happened to Barney Hill's heart that had happened to that penny in the doctor's hand. And
wow.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, we are at a break point. Jim, when we come back, I want you to tell that one more time.
Oh, really?
I like penny stories.
All right.
So we're going to go through that one more time. The story of Dr. Hopkins. Do you recall yesterday when Colonel Corso said the alien bodies rapidly decomposed? Ed Dame said disappeared. And did you just hear what Jim said? We'll be right back. Men in Black tonight. Going back now to my guest, Jim Keith. Or am I doing that a bit prematurely? No, I'm not. Back to Jim Keith. Jim, the story of Dr. Hopkins is one of the coolest stories I've heard in a while. And it meshes with a lot of what we've been talking about. Would you please tell it one more time?
Sure. One of the reasons I like the Dr. Hopkins story is it wasn't anecdotal. When I received it, it was done in very much detail, and this detail was received from Dr. Hopkins' kids, because Hopkins was not talking after this happened. But it took place in Maine in 1976. And Hopkins had been doing some UFO research on his own and regressing a an alleged UFO abductee, when a man showed up at his doorstep, and this was a man in black. This guy was bald. He had very pasty white skin, and apparently he possessed no lips. The lips seem to have been painted on with lipstick, and oddly enough, that's a detail that's repeated in other stories where the facial features are simulated.
Sounds almost like a mime.
Yeah, could be. Could be, or a clone. But this man in black talked about with the doctor about his research, and then he told the doctor that there was a dime and a penny in the doctor's pocket. He reached in, and that's what was there. The man in black instructed the doctor to take the penny in his open hand, and as the doctor looked at the penny with no sleight of hand, this all took place quite slowly. It turned silver, then blue, and then it dematerialized. And the way that the doctor expressed that this had taken place was that he felt the absence of the weight of the penny on his hand. This man in black asked Hopkins if he had ever heard of a well-known UFO abductee, Barney Hill, who had recently died from a heart attack. And Hopkins said that he had heard of Barney Hill. And the man in black informed Dr. Hopkins that, in fact, this was no heart attack, but the same thing had happened to Barney Hill's heart as had happened to the penny in Dr. Hopkins' hand. And that was the last that Hopkins was ever involved in UFO research. He burned all of his tapes, got rid of all of his books, and like I said, the only reason we know about this is because his kids were willing to talk about it.
All right, it would be useful, and we may not know, what exactly Dr. Hopkins was working on when this occurred?
In fact, I have the name of the abductee who Hopkins was hypnotically regressing, but I just don't have it at my fingertips. I believe it's in the book.
All right, so he was regressing somebody,
mm-hmm.
and we can imagine that he was getting close to information that obviously they did not want out.
Right, and that's a familiar theme, of course, with the Men in Black, is that people find out about the secret of the UFOs, or they see a particularly spectacular sighting, and then they are encouraged in no uncertain terms to keep their mouths shut about it.
Well, you know, I can imagine that if somebody like that came to my door, assuming that I lived through the initial sighting of this thing, and it placed it you know, did that to me with a penny in my hand,
mm-hmm.
I would be inclined to go along with Dr. Hopkins. Now, it's easy to sit out here and for the audience to say, oh, wouldn't have stopped me. Baloney. If that occurred to you, you'd think 25 times when something occurred in your very own hand and you were told, well, that's what happened to somebody else's heart, and the obvious direct indication is this could be your heart.
Sure, you know, us fearless UFO researchers and researchers into conspiracy, you don't really know how you would react when push came to shove, and there was a truly significant threat.
Well, I think I know how I'd react. I'd cave big time, assuming I lived through the experience. That would say to you, stop now, or you're not going to live to do any sort of further investigation whatsoever. You're simply going to die.
Yeah.
Yeah, that seems to be the message. All right, well, that was a fascinating case. What else have you for us?
Well, you know, really any number of things, but one aspect that I would like to talk about is sort of UFOs created by government. And I think there are a lot of reasons to believe that the U.S. and maybe other governments have been, in fact, since the early 1950s, testing these kind of exotic aircraft that the men in black might want to shut people up about. And
all right, here's a mystery for you, Jim.
Sure.
You've seen, I'm sure, coverage of the recent lights over Phoenix.
Oh, yeah, sure.
I had a newspaper person down in Arizona sent me a story of his, indicating that some flight or squadron of planes had been flying over Phoenix that night, and this explains everything. The problem is that nobody, the military, the flight controllers at the Phoenix Tower, saw anything on radar. And so, it's a pretty good example. I mean, here you've got an area of 2.5 million people, and a gigantic sighting above that city that lasted not for a split second, but for 106 minutes. Now, what does that tell us? Are they trying to, what are they trying to do? Are they trying to, provoke us?
Well, you know, I don't claim to be an expert on that Arizona Triangle, but here's what I do know is, as you well know, Art, there have been literally thousands of sightings of this triangular craft worldwide.
Yes.
Going back to about 1990.
Yes.
There were about 2,000 sightings in Belgium. Now, in fact, one of the places where this triangular craft is most often seen is around secret testing bases in California, particularly down by Lancaster.
I have seen one, Jim.
Yeah, that's right. I've heard you speak of that. And actually, a military official in Northern California admitted that the triangle is a government craft. He called it a transport. Also, according to Aviation Week in 1991, they said that diamond-shaped and triangular configurations are the trend now. Now, like I said, I'm no expert on this, but this would lead me to believe that there is a technology that we don't know about that includes this very slow-moving, huge craft, and that it's not alien.
Perhaps not. But Jim, it's a big story either way. What flew over me? No.
Sure.
It didn't fly over me, Jim. It floated over
mm-hmm.
me. What came over me was defying gravity,
mm-hmm.
Doing about 30 miles an hour, 150 feet from one point of the triangle to the other, very low, about 150 feet above me, you know, classic stuff, close encounters of the third kind, stars blank out, moon blanks out, this thing passes directly over our head.
Yeah.
And so that's technology that I don't know that we have right now.
That kind of blows my mind as well, but I got a call from a lady who lives just outside of Lancaster about 6 weeks ago, and she lives right in a nexus of about five different secret testing bases down there. And she said that she saw a huge aircraft at very low level, perhaps at about 50 feet. Now, this thing was glowing, but it did one heck of a big circle around her area of tracked homes,
yes.
Moving at an extremely slow speed. So I think the story here is an amazing new, perhaps, anti-gravity technology. But again and again, I never see this smoking gun linking it to the grays with the big eyes.
All right. Let's move back to the Men in Black for a second. Your book begins with an interesting angle, the black arts, demons, witches,
yeah.
That sort of thing.
Sure.
How does that fit in?
Well, you know, these guys, the Men in Black, just as they're described today, have manifested since my earliest cases, I think, go back to the 1500s. And back in those days, they were always referred to as agents of the devil and were usually seen in the context of witchcraft rituals and satanic sabbats.
Really?
And that sort of thing. As we went forward and as we went into the irreligious 20th century, people started interpreting these guys differently, and they were more often seen with UFOs and shutting up witnesses of UFOs, and when people were hassled by the Men in Black, they didn't immediately think, here's an envoy of Satan. They thought of them as extraterrestrials.
All right, I want to read you something. Take a moment out and read you a letter that I've got from a listener, if you wouldn't mind, and see if this fits anywhere into your Men in Black, all right?
Sure.
Art, I want to tell you a true story of the Men in Black. My father had fought cancer for several years. In the fight, he had lost his nose to surgery and had to wear a fake one made for him. He lost all of his teeth and half his jawbone. He suffered through radiation to be told that it was all gone, and 30 days later there was nothing more that radiation could do to save him. Then he went through chemotherapy, sickness only to reach the point that the doctors were continuing to keep him believing it was working. Next, my mother died of a heart attack 2 months after my father was expected to be dead. But he wasn't. But now he was feeling the loss of my mother, and after he had made plans to see that she was taken care of, after he was gone, I can tell you all of this because I've got to know what happened next. The only thing keeping him alive was his insistence that he would see the grave marker installed that he picked out for my mother and himself. As you know, partners frequently go together. I added that. I took him to the gravesite in a wheelchair less than a week before he died. One evening I was sitting at home with my wife and small children when my sister called from my father's house saying she was frightened, wanted me to come right over. When I got there, Dad was insisting that my sister and his caregiver take him home. Of course, he was already home. When I asked where home was, he gave me the address of where he grew up. Insisted I take him there. I really couldn't do that since the house had been sold after the death of his mother. The night later, and we decided that he would be more comfortable at the hospital than at home, the next day I went to see him, he was still wanting to go home. The next evening, my sister and I were with him. He began to talk to us and tell us he was sorry that he had been so much trouble, and he realized how out of it he had been recently. I told him it was all right. He told me he was glad that they had come to visit him and set him straight. I said, "Who came to visit?" And he said, "The men in black." I asked him who they were. And he said he didn't know. But they came to visit him, and they were going to give him a message. Or did give him a message. I asked, "What was the message?" He told me they would return soon to take him to be with my mother. Of course, she was now dead. This is, and it goes on, and it's from Ron. Thank you, Ron. Does that sound at all familiar, Jim?
Yeah, we're talking really an event that is more usually framed in olden days. With the witchcraft connection, or these guys are often seen in, for instance, in a religious area like Ireland, where they're observed at graveside and so forth. So that fits in perfectly, actually.
All right, again, the demonic connection, that goes, you're saying that is where it began around, you think, in the 1500s.
Right.
And they were actually described as men in black even then?
Oh, yeah. In very much in detail, you know, they're black silk suits, and they're black hats, and oftentimes these guys then wouldn't be, of course, driving the black Cadillacs, but they would be driving black coaches or black cars. So it's fairly seamless up until today, but these days I guess they've changed their mode of transportation.
No reason the modern ones, I suppose, shouldn't use automobiles.
It is odd, which is something that is almost too obvious to say about the men in black. They're really an odd collection.
I assume that you have more stories yourself of the appearance of these men.
Yeah, I do.
Enough that you have become convinced yourself there is something to it.
Indeed, and that was really the way it took place. Was I started out initially extremely skeptical about this whole subject, but after reviewing dozens or perhaps at least 100 cases on the men in black, I found that I could explain a great deal of it. I could explain a lot of it as government. I could explain a good deal of it as hoaxers. I could say the detail on this sounds like this UFO buff was imagining all this, but still there was this residue of paranormality. And frankly, I'm not really known as a researcher into the paranormal. I mean, my book, like Black Helicopters Over America, is extremely down to earth and deals with government conspiracy. But with the men in black, they kind of, they made me sit up and take notice about this paranormal aspect.
Well, I will ask you also about Black Helicopters.
Sure.
You know, it's been a favorite for a long time.
Sure.
But the men in black, maybe you can break it down for me. What percentage of the men in black case histories would you say lean toward the paranormal?
I would say a lot of them have paranormal trappings, but the ones that I find unexplainable really probably don't amount to more than 5%. The greatest source, I think, really would be delusion. People see somebody dressed all in black, which is rather common, and then they're feeling rather spooked anyway that day, and they interpret it as a man in black. After that, I would say the government has an involvement, and although it sounds a little bit crazy, reading case after case like this, you finally draw the conclusion that, yeah, the government, in order to more thoroughly shut up witnesses, is counterfeiting this men in black thing. But as far as things that really look paranormal and things that really can't be explained, they are the exception.
Hmm. Well, again, I've had government guys visit, and they are intimidating all by themselves. But what you have described, how many of them, for example, in the case of Dr. Hopkins, appear to come without human faces? We're talking about descriptions here. Are there many like that?
I've probably got at least 25 cases like that.
25 cases?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
When we get back, I want to ask you how you go about collecting Men in Black stories, interviewing people, that sort of thing. How you even begin to build a database for this sort of book. Fascinating. All right, Jim, hold on. We'll be right back. From the high desert, an area near Dreamland, it's just over the hill there. I'm Art Bell, and you're listening to the Independent American CBC Radio Network. My guest is Jim Keith, and he wrote Casebook on the Men in Black. It is creepy. And Jim, I'm going to steal one more minute. We've got, you know, this is radio. We've got a lot of time.
Okay.
And I'm going to ask you about how you collected your stories, but I'm going to give you one that just burned through my fax machine.
Okay.
I think you'll find it interesting. Here we go. Art, I've got to tell you about a Men in Black experience that I had a year ago after an art show I presented called Stranger Than Outer Space. It was at the Vancouver Planetarium and presented 50 artists. The theme, in general, was space, but the topic seemed to lean toward UFO abduction. The show was received very well, and we had over 1,500 people come to our opening night. Lots of people seemed to be open to the whole UFO idea. Anyway, the visitations started happening shortly after I started sending out the press releases. Jody, my girlfriend, woke up frequently seeing tall, black figures in the room looking down on her. Other times it would be simple mysteries, such as coming home to an apartment that had obviously been tampered with. Things like windows being opened in the dead of winter when we were away, furniture moving about. I didn't believe it at first. I didn't want to think that someone was messing with my private life. We had the show. It went well. I was enjoying my time off from organizing and painting the following evening. Jody called me from across the room and told me to come have a look at this. So I looked out the window from my third floor and looked down into the alley. There, I saw two tall men, both in black, both wearing black baseball caps covering their faces. They were just standing there, staring up at us. I stood there for quite a while, having the eerie feeling that I was being scanned. At one point, I nervously waved at them as to sort of pinch myself. One of them coldly put his hand in the air, confirming that it was us they were looking at. Just then, the phone rang. It was one of the other painters from the art show. He began telling me about a strange dream he had had about a saucer. Jody looked over me and said, "They just disappeared. Disappeared." And she had a look on her face that I'll never forget. I ran to the window and saw they were gone. But she said, "Not gone, but disappeared." That's from Mark in Vancouver, B.C., Canada, Jim.
Fairly classic, eh?
Well, I don't know. You tell me. Is it classic?
It sounds right on the mark, really. No pun intended, but there are dozens of these things, and you get that same sort of thing in the 1700s with, you know, people, well, for instance, during the plagues, in the Middle Ages, there were literal armies of men in black manifesting back then. Sometimes, they had sort of medieval trappings about them. They'd be carrying scythes. They'd be seen before outbreaks of the plague. These guys have been around for a while.
Before outbreaks of plague?
Exactly.
Would you then jump to the conclusion that they might have been the source?
You know, it's quite possible, and there are other ways that we could look at this as well. To me, one thing that I've looked at is that reality is maybe a little bit more edgy and malleable than we normally give it credit for. And I'm thinking that the men in black and perhaps a lot of other paranormal circumstances manifest as a reaction to trauma. And my guess is that probably the days of the plague in the Middle Ages were pretty traumatic.
Oh, yes.
But in a way, I think that we may externalize and really shape the horror of a UFO encounter or of a plague encounter or of a death encounter into a true and a real exterior event that takes place. Now, I'm not saying it's not real, and I'm not saying that this is an hallucination, but I think that exterior reality reflects far more our interior reality, and particularly our reality of trauma, than we imagine.
Huh. Dan in Lexington, Kentucky would like to know, have you ever heard of, and it follows, women in black? Has there ever been a case of a woman in black?
Off the top of my head, I only recollect one case, and that was during the Mothman encounters back in 66 and 67, which is a wild set of events that I'd love to go into.
Go into it.
Okay. In West Virginia, particularly a town called Point Pleasant, in 66 and 67, there were literally dozens of sightings of UFOs, there were giant birds, winged humanoids, cattle mutilations, and lots of MIB, lots of men in black. And my sense is there was an original paranormal element to that, but then it started to snowball. For instance, John Keel, the main investigator of Mothman, who wrote a book about it, had a background in military intelligence.
You know what? I really don't know. There was a Mothman cartoon or something, but you're telling me about something that really occurred. Who or what was Mothman?
Mothman was this huge, weird-looking humanoid with big wings that there were probably at least 100 sightings of this guy in West Virginia. In fact, there were a few varieties of Mothman and giant birds. It's an extraordinary a UFO flap, as it were. Another guy that investigated the Mothman was Gray Barker. He was a famous UFO writer back in the 50s. He also happened to be a prolific hoaxer. But while I think that it might have started out with a paranormal element, I think it may have been that the government tweaked this and they used it as a psychological operation or a test tube to try out various forms of psychological control. And it may have been that there was advanced testing going on nearby, but it has been a conglomerate of real paranormality and plus a heavy government involvement as well as hoaxing. Anybody who is interested in the paranormal has to read The Mothman Prophecies by John Keel.
All right. Well, you know, as in the fax that was sent to me a little while ago, if I were doing this sort of work, which I do now that I think about it, and I were to look out my window and there were to appear two men in black just standing there, just staring, whose faces I could not make out, and I stared back, and then finally one of them raised their hands to indicate they meant me, I would take that as a very dire message indeed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And now that I've said it, I'll probably have exactly that happen.
Yeah, that may go along with what I was talking about, externalizing your viewpoint. If you're paranoid of something, it's no doubt going to end up on your doorstep.
Just about everything else has happened to me, so why not the men in black? All right, any other case histories that you'd care to lay on us that you personally consider to be the more interesting?
You know, if I may, Art, could I be real mercenary here and give a number where people could get a copy of the book?
Of course.
Okay. Okay, it's a casebook on the Men in Black, and it costs $14.95.
Oh, is that all?
Yeah, and you can get it at 1-800-680-INET, I-N-E-T, 1-800-680-INET.
All right, I like numbers better. Do you know what the numbers are?
In fact, I don't.
You don't?
I don't.
See, that makes everybody converted. 1-800-INET, so that would be 1-800-4.
Yeah.
Let me do it. 4-6-3-8.
Better thee than me, because I would have taken 5 minutes figuring it out.
Well, I've got an old-fashioned phone here. You see, that's the problem. You know, a lot of the new phones don't put that on there for you. I mean, they've just got numbers, so you've got to remember to give it both ways, I have learned. So,
okay.
$14 and how much?
$14.95.
All right. It's a pretty good-sized book, too, isn't it? It's, over 216 pages. So it's a good-sized book. Anyway, be my guest. What else can you tell us about the Men in Black?
Well, there are many, many interesting encounters. One that I find quite fascinating is that apparently Adolf Hitler encountered a man in black.
Oh?
According to a Governor Roschning of Danzig, Germany, who knew Hitler early in his career, Hitler would wake up the night screaming that he had seen these people dressed in black and that they were the new men and that they were intrepid and cruel and that they horrified him, but that this was the future. And as to whether that's a real man in black story, whether it was a real paranormal encounter or just a case of Hitler having the DTs, I really don't know, but I found it interesting.
All right, well, that's Germany, harder to trace. What about here? What about President Kennedy's assassination?
Well, you know, there are a lot of men in black occurrences that are centered around the Kennedy assassination. Apparently, on one of the films taken of the motorcade, there is a man in black with a black cape and some old-fashioned hat standing right there at the motorcade. I mean, perhaps it's just a coincidence. There's another case that is perhaps even more interesting, and that is of a fellow named Castillo, who was apprehended in the late 1960s in the Philippines, apparently involved in an assassination attempt on Marcos.
Oh.
Now, when he was apprehended, the Philippine police or Secret Service or whatever they were used a truth drug on him, at which time Castillo came out with this story that apparently he was a multiple personality disorder, and he had like four or more discrete personalities, each with a name, each with an identity, and in fact, I believe he was carrying a number of different ID cards as well. It's a wild story in itself, but the payoff on it was that he believed that he had been involved in an assassination attempt on the president in 63, and that his controller had been a man in black who drove a black Cadillac, who had pasty skin and so forth. So that's probably the best thing I know in terms of the Kennedy assassination.
All right. What do we know about what the men in black have actually done? For example, are the vast majority of the cases simple intimidation? And it's really not simple if you're intimidated. Or do we know instances where men in black, beyond the Dr. Hopkins story, have killed?
I don't know of any instances where a man in black killed anyone, but there are a lot of truly sinister stories from the old days that, like I said, involve these sort of witchcraft elements. It seems that half of the people that were involved with men in black back in those days were involved in eating children and abducting people and in sacrifice and so forth. I don't know.
In doing what with children?
Well, I hate to even mention it, but
Eating?
Eating, yeah.
Eating as in Jeffrey Dahmer eating?
Indeed. Yeah. Yeah. And if I had to say over again,
man,
I think I would have omitted that detail. But yeah, a lot of those old time stories really are pretty darn sinister.
I was convinced when I was a child that there was something in my closet that would have eaten me given half an opportunity to get out. And to this very day, and people can laugh as I will, I close closets. I don't go to sleep with open closets because that's where things that would eat you come from. I'm serious. You know, it began that way as a child. You know, when you'd go under the covers.
You know, I think childhood offers sometimes a pretty clear doorway into the archetypes of our existence, into the nitty gritty. I remember as a child, I felt like I was being sucked up into the air and out of the house. And at the time, I had no way of really framing it or understanding it. Looking back on it, I think there might have been something interesting going on there.
Well, I am convinced, Jim, that children, in their innocence, before they have been, in effect, mind-conditioned not to believe in the unbelievable, do it because it's real. I mean, it really is there, so they see and hear and imagine things that later on they are trained not to believe in. So they don't see them later, or they're not aware of them, but the young, innocent, new mind sees things the older, mature, brainwashed mind does not.
Right, and you know, that cuts back into my thesis about that we manifest our own reality in the sense that kids often have a number of imaginary playmates. I mean,
yep.
This is very, very common, and it may be that this isn't delusion, but as we grow older, as we solidify,
yep.
We exclude these other beings, and it's simply us from then on out. It may be that we are simply changing in terms of our approach and cutting out a lot of the messages and a lot of the beings that are truly around us.
You've got it. All right, Jim. Good cutoff point. Stay right there. Men in Black. There's more to come. I'm Art Bell, and this is CBC. From Russell in Kansas City, Art, you seem troubled by this Men in Black stuff. Nobody seems to have trouble talking about men in white. We call them angels, I believe. So if we believe in angels, does it not follow that there should be men in black? Is that a proper attitude, Jim?
You know, I saw I'm just reminded of this. I saw a show, it was like, I don't know, the something soap hour back in 1955 or something. This was in very early days TV, and it was about a man in white and a man in black who came to this small town and circulated amongst the people, and the rumor mills got going and so forth. And the man in black was characterized as being a devil or an evil man and so forth, and they finally ended up running the man in black out of town, at which time the man in white made it clear what his purposes was or were, which was that he, in fact, was the evil controller, and that a fashion statement doesn't necessarily always indicate a person's orientation.
Oh, my gosh. It's a good point. As a matter of fact, a very dear friend of mine for many years is in Nevada with us, and you're in Reno, right?
That's correct.
All right. Well, I'm not far from Las Vegas. In Las Vegas, there is John Lear, and the son of Bill Lear. And he did, for years and years, research UFOs and said something to me once that has always bugged me and will until the day I die, and then possibly even beyond that. He said, you know, it's funny, Art, everybody tells you when you die, go to the light, go to the light, go to the light, the light tunnel, all the rest of it. He said, I have been told by reliable sources, it's a trick. It's a trick. And if you go to the light, you're going exactly where you don't want to be going. He said, in fact, you should go to the darkness. And I have almost cursed John ever since for telling me that. So I tell it to my audience. It's something you can sit there and think a little bit about. Fashion statements, huh?
You know, I'd heard the same thing from a fellow who wrote a book called War in Heaven, which was a pretty interesting a book about the way that astral beings control the earth. And he said the same darn thing. Watch out for that light.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, thanks. That reinforces something to wonder about.
That leaves us in a heck of a position, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. All right. let's take the remainder of this half hour and still talk about the Men in Black and ask you what other instances, for example, around, I know, before I even get to that, my wife said you asked him about about a woman in black, and he said there was only one story, and she said, I want to hear it, because somehow we got launched into Mothman.
Well, then, what I would say is for your dear wife to crack the darn book. It's a complicated story, and frankly, I don't remember a lot of the details. I'm sort of, in many ways, I'm kind of the mad professor. I dive in to whatever book I'm working on at the time and immerse myself in that subject. And if I've done a book like The Men in Black about a year ago, sometimes the details drop out. I swim in a lot of detail art.
All right. I was going to ask you, and now I shall. I have retrieved already a couple of stories from listeners tonight about The Men in Black. How do you get them?
Well, you know, one thing I would like to say is that I think that when we start getting calls, you might be surprised at the frequency of Men in Black stories. I mean, they are all over the place.
I know the phones are ringing off the hook, but I still want to know, without the resource that I have to just say I want to talk about the Men in Black, let me hear it, you know, how do you go about collecting stories for a book?
Well, it's almost an intuitive thing. I don't really think about how to do it. Primarily, I have fun with it. And I start off by contacting my friends and a network of researchers that I'm associated with. I mean, you know, around the world, I'm on a friendly basis with perhaps at least 50 researchers in this area.
Right.
Then I gather and read everything on the topic. And with the Men in Black, I expect I probably must have read at least 50,000 pages. There is a good deal of material on this. And then as I read this material, I isolate names and addresses and so forth out of the material. I get on the willing to talk on the subject. With the Men in Black, there were quite a few people who were reticent about it, but there are other experts on the subject, and I talk to experts and quite a few people who had encounters. But of course, with any book, and I expect you probably felt this way about The Quickening, is as soon as the book is done, then comes the avalanche of great stories.
That's of course correct, yes. Mm-hmm. All right, any other favorites? You have a chapter here called On a Bender. What is it? What is that all about?
What that was is an early UFO buff who edited a magazine about UFOs and ran a UFO organization.
Right.
He claimed that he was contacted by three men in black who told him the ultimate secret about UFOs, what they were really about, and then took him, initially he said that they were government and they told him to shut up about it. As time went on and as the dollar signs kind of arose in his back brain, the story got more convoluted and he went to the planet Kazik where everybody was naked and it was quite a joyride he had in the UFO. But originally it was just him being involved in UFOs and then three men in black contacting
him. You mean an entire closed optional planet?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah. And apparently this story had a good deal of currency among UFO buffs back then. But, you know, the Men in Black were really quite apparent right at the beginning of UFO research, around 47 through the early 50s. In fact, one of the earliest encounters that took place 13 days before the famous Kenneth Arnold encounter where he saw the UFOs over, I think it was Mount Rainier, was the Maury Island affair, and that was the sighting of three donut-shaped UFOs that allegedly dropped metal and slag upon a boat near Tacoma. And after this took place, a man in black the following day contacted the leading witness, man named Harold Dahl, and told him to keep his mouth shut about it. So it goes right back to the beginning of UFO research.
You did say donut shaped, didn't you?
That's right.
I bet that's something a cop would never report. It gets me in a lot of trouble. All right, look, why don't we take some calls?
I'd love it.
And see what the audience has to say about all of this. Here we go. We'll just punch them up. You never know what you're going to get, I'm telling you.
Maybe it's a man in black, eh?
You know, are you a Canadian?
Are you speaking to me?
Yes.
No, I'm not.
You're not. But you say, hey, just like a Canadian does.
Okay.
East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Jim Keith. Hi.
Hello, Art. Is my radio causing interference?
No, I don't hear it.
Okay.
But I would prefer you do not have it on in any form when you get on the air.
Yes, okay. Should I turn it off now?
Yes, you should turn it off.
All right, hold on.
Absolutely. Everybody, please do that. It's impossible to conduct a conversation
otherwise. Okay, this is Tim in St. Louis.
Yes, Tim.
I have a couple of things just to bring up. One is that it seems to me that in just reading ghost stories, like it, you know, all throughout my life,
yes,
it seems like I've heard quite a few references actually to women in black. And usually they're, you know, purported to be some sort of ghost of a woman who's been deceased or something like that. But it does seem like women in black have appeared. And something else, the second thing that I'd like to
mention, a lot of them are witches, I suspect.
Maybe. But another thing that I'd like to mention is the total preponderance throughout the British Isles,
yes,
of stories of black dogs. And their behavior, in animal fashion, of course, is almost identical to what I've heard of the behavior of the men in black.
And let us not forget, black cats.
Yes, but the black dogs are often so much more sinister. They'll appear, and, you know, you won't even be able to see their eyes or any part of their face, and then suddenly they'll just vanish into mist, you know?
Yeah, I wouldn't like that.
Yeah, and supposedly they're, you know, they're familiars of, you know, witches or of, you know, necromancers or something like that. So maybe these men in black are something similar.
Fair comment, Jim?
Good point, Jim. One thing that what you said reminded me was that trolls and fairies and witches originally were conceived of as being men and women in black. They were identical, but as time has gone by and with kind of fantasization, like for instance the work of Shakespeare, they've been turned into other things. For instance, fairies now have wings and are tiny, but originally witches and trolls and fairies were pretty much the same breed. And like I said, sometimes details drop out in my memory of my research, but now that I think about it, in Ireland the fairies were men and women in black.
Really?
Yeah.
That isn't the way I pictured a fairy in Ireland at all.
Sure. Sure. From what I understand, it was Shakespeare who turned our heads around about fairies and conceived of them as being kind of sprightly creatures.
Okay. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Jim Keith. Good evening.
Hi, Art. This is Chuck from Fresno.
Hi, Chuck.
When I was about 7 or 8 in 1970 or 71, I had no knowledge of men in black at that age, and I had a dream where two men in black came to my house, took me and my parents in a big black car, like a Lincoln Continental.
Really?
And they took us to a field that I had never been at that time, and yet later in my life, that was a place that I would go to. A friend's house was near there. And there was a corrugated metal warehouse.
Yes.
Which in that area there actually was a, it was like a garage where this guy had all these old T-birds.
Yes.
And in there it was very dark, very gothic looking, and there was a suit of armor in there. And then my father was taken to a chopping block, and an executioner was about to cut his head off with a really big axe.
What?
And that's all I remember. And, you know, my father's fine, and it was a dream.
It was a dream.
Yeah, but I had a, when I was younger than that, I was supposed in 68, I had a sighting that I, you know, I can only say it was a dream, yet I think it was real. And I, you know, I have to wonder if that's connected. And then in about 88, I had a UFO sighting that I know was real, because I had somebody see it, but it was a light in the sky, so you can't see anything.
All right,
that.
Well, then let's translate this to a question for Jim that kind of goes down that alley. Jim, are a lot of the men in black sightings, how many of them are ambiguous in the sense that the person, after it's over, is not quite sure whether it was a dream or really happened?
As surprising as it might be, a minimal number. Most of the men in black sightings that I have run across tend to be the ones that people want to talk about or get into print or are very significant. And usually the kind of waking dream or the ambiguous ones don't really get communicated that much. So in fact, the number that has to do with dreaming in what I have dug up is minimal.
Pretty small, all right. First time caller line. Whoops, you would have been. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Jim Keith. Good morning.
Good morning, Art. This is John from Long Island, New York again.
Hi, John.
I have a question for your guest. Where do these men in black come from?
Well, that's a good question, and I suppose if we had the answer, it would not be a mysterious casebook. We'd simply be telling you where they come from.
We'd be conducting tours there at $15 a pop.
Yeah, that's right. So, do you have a best guess?
Yeah. In fact, I don't have the specific call letters of the military operation that is alleged to be a source of men in black encounters, but it is listed in the book, and that is one source. And then on the other hand, the paranormal, if you're looking for those guys' addresses, I think that they cross dimensions, you know, and probably are human, and it takes a lot for me to admit that, but I think their address may be pretty tenuous.
West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Jim Keith. Hi.
Yes, hello.
Hello.
Are you a screener?
No, we don't have a screener, sir. I'm Art Bell. Turn your radio off, please.
Okay, the radio is off.
All right. Now, see, we don't screen calls here.
Okay, very good. I have a question with regard to the foliage in the circles and the other forms that are being drawn in fields.
All right. We are not in open lines right now, as you can tell if you're listening.
I'm listening.
We have a guest.
Well, I thought that...
No, it's not open line.
Okay, very good. I take that as the answer. Thank you. Goodbye.
Okay, take care. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Jim Keith. Good evening.
Hi.
Hi.
We're on the air now?
I hope so.
Oh, good. I've been listening to the Men in Black, and I had a question. A lot of the stories I hear about this, it's usually they're trying to discourage people from following up on these UFO experiences.
Yes.
How often have they followed through on their threats? I mean, is there any documented cases where people have been injured? And if so, what is the percentage to the number of people who haven't been injured?
Very, very good question. How many documented cases, Jim, that you heard of where there was follow through?
You know, I've known of a couple of cases where people were beat up. Certainly cases where people were browbeaten and truly harassed verbally. As far as murder, I don't recall any cases. I don't think I list any in the book. I don't think I know of any cases like that.
Of course, you might not.
That's true.
Because
that's true. How would
the old
know?
Saying goes, dead men tell no tales.
How would anyone know?
Yes. First time caller line, you're on the air with Jim Keith. Hello.
Hi. So glad to talk to you. Let me tell you about something that I saw, and then you tell me.
All right, where are you here?
Oh, I'm in Montgomery, Alabama.
Okay.
About 1987, something like that, on a 60-minute program, maybe even 2020, they were conducting an interview with a man who, the story was about him having cancer.
Yeah.
Because he worked at a government plant or contracted plant somewhere in the mid-north, and I don't remember where.
Right.
And he was complaining that he had not been told that anything he was working with could create, you know, a safety hazard.
Right.
And he mentioned something along the lines of EMI or energy transmission device, something like that. While he's talking, there's a picture in a picture, top left-hand corner. It's on for 1 or 2 seconds. It's a photograph taken from a telephoto lens showing it's a boomerang shape. It is not as wide as a boomerang, okay, but it's a boomerang shape, a little narrower.
Yes.
And it's luminescent.
Yes.
There's two helicopters carrying it. It's one on each side of it. And I don't know how wide a helicopter, you know, span is or anything. So there's two helicopters carrying it, and it's a still photo. It was up there for 2 seconds. Okay? Everybody is paying attention to what the man's saying, and I'm looking at the television screen going, what is that? We don't have any of those. I wonder if this is not part of some of these aircraft that are being seen, perhaps not the whole craft, but part of it, because it was literally luminescent. It wasn't gleaming like chrome or anything like that, and it was a daylight photo.
Does this in any way relate to the Men in Black?
Well, point being is there was no news coverage, there was no mention of it, I couldn't find anybody else that had seen it, and I certainly did wonder if the Men in Black did not pay a visit that very day, and maybe even make a telephone call first, so you better have it ready when we get there. Would that be a reason why you would not hear anything? If you see something like that that you've never seen before, well, the aurora comes to mind, but I don't know what the aurora looks like.
Well, here's a theory, and let's run this by Jim. Jim, could it be that the Men in Black don't show up when you get stories that sort of add to the lore and the whoever it is that's controlling all this, you know, doesn't mind. They virtually want it out. But when somebody really gets close to something that's real, then the Men in Black show up. Could that be?
Good call, Art.
All right. We'll be right back. We're going to break here at the top of the hour, and I'll tell you what I would like after the top of the hour. I am going to screen some calls now, and I want only those of you who have encountered Men in Black to call.
And ask and ye shall receive. I said only calls now from people who have actually encountered a Man in Black. And lo and behold, the phone lines are full now of nothing but. And normally I would go to commercial now and get those out of the way. But instead, I've got a caller on a cell phone way out there someplace or another. So, Jim, I'm going to quickly bring him online. And, caller, you're on the air. Where are you calling from?
Morning, Art. This is Greg Hankridge. How you doing?
Fine, Greg. What's going on?
Well, a number of years ago, I was a nurse at the University of Utah down in Salt Lake City. I worked on the med-surgical floor up there. And one weekend, I happened to be taking care of a patient. Are you familiar with Dugway Proving Ground?
I am.
Indeed.
I was taking care of a patient. I imagine he must have been Army. He had short cropped hair. He had broken his leg while out at Dugway working with something that he didn't want to talk about.
Okay.
And, you know, me, I'm kind of nosy. I would try to get it out of him, never did.
Sure.
So, anyways, that day, he knew he was going to be transferred. That day, two guys show up. Now, they weren't wearing sunglasses, but they were wearing suits. And they were rather intimidating-looking individuals. But they came to pick him up. Now, you would have figured Dugway, Army, you know, they would have been Army corpsmen or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But these guys show up, they're in suits, civilian clothing, they wouldn't say where they were taking them. As a matter of fact, you know, at hospitals, when you transfer a patient, this is what I thought was really peculiar, you normally, will give copies of records for it to go along with the patient.
Medical
records. Right. They refuse to allow the originals to remain at the facility. As a matter of fact, they would not leave the nursing floor with the patient. They kept them on a gurney. Until they talked with my nurse manager and they pulled her off to the side. Next thing you know, she handed him the record and he was gone and was just disappeared, you know.
So,
gone.
Okay.
Nobody knew where he was going.
Uh-huh.
With the records. He had no records of him ever being there.
All right. So, medical Men in Black.
Yeah. So, there's a good example of your basic governmentally connected Men in Black. That's one of the major categories. You know, if you'd like, Art, I've got a pretty cool Dugway Proving Ground story.
All right. Coming up after the commercial break, all right?
Okay.
Let me go ahead and do that. I wanted to let him tell that story because he was on cellular from Alaska.
The story I wanted to tell is kind of tangential to the Men in Black in that it has to do with government cover-up, specifically at Dugway, and it also has to do with cattle mutilation.
Oh?
Yeah. Now, usually when we hear media representations of cattle mutilations, they're always connected to UFOs.
Generally.
But in fact, in terms of my research, it seems that black helicopters are just as often observed during these incidents.
That is true.
Yeah. Now, I'm not saying there's not a paranormal element, but there are clues to another thing here, which is government involvement. It's been found that many mutilated cattle have nicotine in their bloodstreams.
Excuse me, nicotine?
Nicotine. And what that is the most common ingredient that is used in tranquilizer guns. And also, many of these cattle have been marked with fluorescent paint apparently for identification.
Wait. Nicotine, I always thought nicotine increased heart rate, was kind of like a cup of coffee.
Well, I'm told that nicotine is used in tranquilizer guns.
I'll be darned.
I'm not an expert on it.
Okay.
But they've been marked with fluorescent paint, but also, it's been found that a lot of these cattle have been infected with Clostridium bacteria. Have you heard that, Mark?
No, what is that?
Okay. Clostridium is a biowarfare agent that the CIA has admitted to stockpiling.
Oh, great.
Yeah. And the most, along with this, the most horrific thing that I know about the mutilation came from workers at Dugway. And that is that they stated that cattle have been used in the testing of a specifically anti-ethnic warfare agent due to a similarity in the membrane of the cow's eye. And that comes from real guys at Dugway.
Anti-ethnic?
Anti-ethnic. Specifically an anti-oriental biowarfare agent.
You know, it's interesting you should say that, because I've got a fax here that says, Art, you may have covered this already, but I've read that most men in black are of Asian origin.
A lot of them are, or a lot of them look Asian. I don't necessarily think that they're Orientals, because there are other factors involved here, too. Many of them have very long fingers, elongated faces. Their temperatures are cold. But indeed, that Oriental or even Tahitian features is a very common element in Men in Black stories.
Well, I suppose that anything that would describe a being or a person with slitted or slanted eyes might be described by most people in a generalized way as Oriental.
It could be.
Yeah, okay. First time caller line, you're on the air with Jim Keith. Hi.
Hi, Ars. This is Gina from Sacramento.
Hello, Gina.
Hi, and thank you for your service. I love it. Anyway, I wanted to tell you a strange story. I was in the midst of starting up my own little contactee support group back in 1991.
Your phone is breaking up on us a little, hon.
Oh, I'm sorry. Are you going to be able to deal with that?
I think so.
Okay, I'm sorry. We just moved, and it's not the best right now. But I'll go ahead and make my phone call short.
Okay.
Anyway, I was starting my own group, and I was living with my ex-husband in some small cottages in our midtown area. And one very early morning, just after my husband left for work, I was in that kind of state of twilight consciousness.
Sure.
And a very sudden paralysis came over me. I fought it with everything I could, and before my eyes could finally get open, I just, out of the corner of my eyes, saw a very tall, whitish-gray man with these bright red, looked like painted lips. And the suit was jet black, and there was a very tall, black top hat. It reminded me of a very tall cowboy hat. I don't recall any eyes, but sitting in my rocking chair is where he decided to seat himself, and with a sinister grin, his arm stretched out and pulled out like this strange clown face and said, "This is who I am." And I said, whoa, to myself, I'm going, wait a minute, get out of this bad dream you're in.
I hear you.
And I just had to composure myself, and I said, get out of my room. Get out of my room. You don't belong here, and I don't want you ever coming back.
And
before I knew it, the arm stretched back and snapped into its normal shape, and the face was gone. And the man just looked at me again in this strange face and said, you'll never know, and you'll never tell. And I said again, get out of my room, get out of my room. And it stood up before me. It went in a counterclockwise spin into my hardwood floor until it was gone.
Oh, my God.
I have no idea if this is a real MIB experience or if I was just having a very bizarre dream.
Well, let us...
I had never heard of MIBs before this happened.
All right, let us ask the man who wrote the book, Casebook on the Men in Black.
So now you know I'm speaking sooth. But, you know, as an example of that, this is really an archetype that goes a ways back. In the Macumba religion, which is closely related to voodoo, the men in black are very, very close to a couple of presiding spirits, or they call them saints. And one is known as Omulu, or Old Black, and he dresses in black, and he sides with evil in this battle for the earth. And he prefers to hang out in cemeteries. The other spirit in this ancient African religion is called Exu, and he also is associated with black magic, and wears a black suit and a top hat, and he likes to hang out at crossroads, which in terms of ancient mythology and in terms of occultism, crossroads are well known as being very sites that are very pregnant in terms of paranormal manifestation.
Yes, that is correct. But that lady, what she saw, the way it disappeared, the paranormal.
We know everything about men in black in their paranormal manifestation, and it gets us nowhere. I mean, they might as well be an unknown species that we only cross paths with occasionally, like, for instance, Bigfoot, or I believe the panda was believed to be mythological until the turn of this century. We know everything about them, and yet we can't begin to say what they are.
And yet, what you remember the early description, she said, of the face, no lips.
Right.
Lipstick painted on.
Mm-hmm.
Those stories that they wish to allow out, to allow a myth to grow that is not harmful to what's really going on, they allow out.
Mm-hmm.
However, when somebody stumbles into the real thing, then these guys show up.
Yeah, and you know, I'm thinking that just, you know, this has never occurred to me, but I'm thinking that the UFO connected men in black are probably more frequently the government contact, whereas simple manifestations of these strange darklings who just scare the wits out of you may be more closely linked to the paranormal.
Uh-huh. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Jim Keith. Good morning. Hello there.
Yes, me.
Turn your radio off, please, ma'am.
It's not on.
Okay, then whatever's in the background, please quiet it down.
Can you be quiet for a minute? Just a minute.
Thank you.
Okay, this is Sue from Fort Everett, New York.
All right.
Hi, Ad. I love your show.
Thank you.
I thought I had coined the phrase, the men in black. I've been saying this since 1970. I had worked in a growing electronics plant out in Boston. And the engineer that I was working with was given this device brought in from... Can I tell you the name of the company?
Sure.
Bendix.
I remember Bendix.
Do you remember Bendix?
Sure, I do.
Okay. Well, John, the head engineer, had worked on this device for like 6 months. I don't know what he was doing. But at the end, they had me work with him for the delicate work putting this thing together.
Yes.
And all of a sudden, it was done, it was tested, and these three men in black came. And they were solemn, and you should have seen, I mean, everyone was running when they come in, and they took everything that we had done, all our work, our blueprints, this mechanism, and they left. And so I asked John after, I said, John, who are these men in black? And they told us this device that we had worked on was for fuel getting over 50 miles or better of fuel consumption on cars.
Ah, petroleum men in black.
Yeah. Well, I've been coining this phrase, the men in black took it away, you know, for years now.
All right. Well, here's one that's not so funny. Jim, when Nikola Tesla passed, there were men who showed up and confiscated every scrap of his work and his records, and they disappeared like that. You aware of that story?
I've heard it, yes.
Uh-huh. Think that sounds like something that you would attribute to the men in black?
It sounds pretty darn governmental, and you know, just wearing a I have a friend who spoke about wearing black suits and dressing in mirrored sunglasses. He was also bald, and he said that when he walked through the grocery store aisle that people stepped out of the way. So there is something daunting just about that look. It sounds, like I said, I think there's both the governmental and the paranormal connection.
Gotcha. All right. Back in a moment. This is CBC. This is very interesting. And I want you to hear it, Jim. This is from SciTech's Ed Dames, a well-known remote viewer. With regard to the Dugway Proving Ground incident, he says, for individuals with certain classes of security clearances, anesthesia may not be administered except under strictly controlled conditions. If an uncleared doctor operates on such an individual, the doctor is subject to being debriefed by representatives, spooks, debriefed by rep agencies who need not briefify themselves, other abuse who need not B's and C's, badger abuse who need not B's and C's, have to sign an official inadvertent disclosure statement. In other words, you will never repeat them. In other words, you imprisonment. No kidding. If the patient happened to disclose classified information when under an aside in Men in Black kind of deal, huh?
You know, in fact, I ran across some documentation on that just a few days ago. I'm currently working on a book about mind control operations in the United States.
Oh.
And I read a declassified CIA memo that talked about that anesthesia should not be used agents when they had operations or whatever. I don't remember the whole of it, but it seemed to go right along with that.
There you are. All right, and this one coming from Wayne Green, who publishes 73 Magazine, and could have come from Ed Dames. It says, hi all, it sounds as if my explanation for the Men in Black, May 29th program, is holding up. I proposed they are a cleanup crew from the future, sent back to change anything that has changed the future. Wayne Green.
Take that from a different angle. Perhaps they're a cleanup crew from the present, in the sense that time may be an illusion. And like I was saying, perhaps when people react to the trauma of a UFO encounter or some kind of a traumatic event, that is externalized to clean up their neurological situation, to reject that horror out into the environment.
Mm-hmm. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Jim Keith. Hi.
Hello. All I want to say is that I'm in California.
All right.
About 2 years ago, I suffered an episode of missing time. I was out after I got off work late at night, and I was stopped at a red light, and then the next thing I knew, I was 20 miles away, and an hour had passed. And at the time, I didn't know anything about missing time or anything like that, so I just kind of let it go. About a week later, I was out, and I had stopped at a gas station and was getting gas. Again, it was at night. And this, I just remember this man being very tall and in a nice black suit, walked up to me and told me that I was going to give him a ride. And I said, no, I don't want to give you a ride. Why don't you ask another man for a ride? And he kept saying, no, you're going to give me a ride. So I quickly put my gas cap back on, went around and got in the driver's side of the car. And I thought the passenger side was locked. But when I got in the car, he was already in the car. And he pulled me in, and I started to scream. And he told me if I kept screaming that he would kill me, that he just wanted me to drive him around. So I proceeded to drive, and he kept telling me, nothing has happened to you. You won't remember anything. And I ran a stop sign, and he looked over at me and said, I know what you're trying to do, and if the police pull us over, I will immediately kill you.
Good.
And he just kept repeating, nothing happened to you. Nothing happened. You'll never tell anybody. Nothing happened. Then we got out in the middle of nowhere. I'm still shook up about this. I'm afraid as I talk about it. He got out of the car, and he looked at me, and I'll never forget. It's like his eyes weren't there, and he said, leave now, because I don't want to hurt you. I drove away. I started to cry after I got away from him, and I got it back into town, and I drove around town until I found a police officer. When the police officer got to me, I was broke up and told him, and the police were already looking for me because the clerk at the liquor store had seen the man get in my car and heard him scream. They were looking for me in my car and a man in a black suit that had gotten in my car.
Holy smokes. Did they ever find
it? No. And it's a very small town that I live in. That's why I don't want to say where I'm at.
I hear you.
They never found him. Never. And he's never been seen again. But I've had instances, I won't even drive at night anymore, where a black automobile has came up behind me and been flashing its lights, wanting me to pull over, seems like, and I just get home as fast as I can. I won't even drive anymore. I've since, this has happened, been diagnosed with agoraphobia, where I will not leave my house. I will not leave my house unless someone's with me.
I can't say that I blame you. Jim, have you ever heard a story like that?
It sounds pretty classic. In fact, I've heard stories just like that. Related.
Yeah, I thought I was going crazy.
Yeah, I've heard stories just like that, actually.
All right, well, caller, I don't know what to tell you, but I might react as you have. I might not be going out a lot at night.
Do you think that he did this to me because of the episode of Missing Time?
Oh, now there's an intriguing question. Jim,
Well, you know, missing time can go both ways. It can be an anomalous event, a kind of a paranormal twisting of time. But at the same time, you know, there are such things as government mind control programs, and there are I believe it's Halpidol is the drug that specifically in overdose gives incidents of missing time. So lacking any further data. It's really hard to say if we're looking at paranormality or just massive arrogance of an agent.
Or could it relate to the missing time incident? Sure it could. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Jim Keith. Hello.
This is Bob from Bay Town.
Hello, Bob.
This happened to me about, I'm not real sure. It could be either 3 or 4 years ago now.
Yes.
But y'all were talking about you had never seen their eyes. Well, me and a couple of my friends did see their eyes. And this what's so funny about it is, or we're weird, is before we saw these guys in Men in Black, or as y'all call them, we all saw something that was really strange. We were going out, and we were going down this road and here by us, and we thought, you know, we saw a police helicopter, you know, flashing its light on the ground, you know,
yes,
looking for maybe someone who broke into a house or a drug deal or something.
Sure,
other
sure.
People
sure.
Well, we were stopped stopped at a stoplight, and there was a bunch of us. They were in different automobiles, but the light was real long, so we were all going, look, they're going, you know, cop got someone, you know, because the light had stopped at some point, and we kept watching this going through all these lights. Because it was way down the road from us, and you know, we were going, oh crud, they're gonna stop us or keep us from going to where we were trying to get to. Anyway, the light stopped and it was pointing down at the ground. Well, we all said, well, they got him, you know, and then the light turned off, and the next thing we know, we're at another stoplight watching the police helicopter, which we thought it was, and most of us still sort of think it might have been, but it couldn't have been because when it decided to leave, it just, I mean, oof, it was gone. I mean, it zipped. I mean, it was gone and nothing flat. I mean, you couldn't even track it.
You said you saw eyes.
Yeah, this is where we're getting to. Well, we got to the place where we were going, and it was a club we were going to, and we were all inside. We hadn't been there maybe 20 minutes when a friend of mine tapped me on the shoulder going, look, this, you know, because we were all standing there watching to see if anybody came in, or a friend. There came in four guys dressed in black suits.
Yes.
And this doesn't make any sense, because this is here in Texas at it was at a bar, and there are four guys in black suits. And we hadn't been drinking at all, others yet, but it was so weird because they came in, they were dressed in black suits, and they had sunglasses on. Well, you don't walk into a club with sunglasses on at night,
right.
You know, they don't want you to, you know, hurt, fall over or something or whatever.
Right.
Well, the bouncer told them to take their sunglasses off. Well, these guys did. And that when we finally noticed that they were sort of dogging us all, I mean, all of us, anytime we walked around the bar, they were, you know, maybe 10 feet away or 5 feet away every time we moved around the bar.
And their eyes, what about their eyes?
They're, you know, that weird, gray looking color. It has black, you know, on the outer part, and then there's a real light gray or blue gray.
Yeah.
These are four guys. They all not the same height or the same, look
but,
the same.
But all with the same eyes.
All with the same eyes.
All right. Jim, Is that consistent with stories you've heard?
These guys are really charming, you have to admit, Art. But, you know, the details on the Men in Black vary, and they vary in very strange ways. Sometimes the Men in Black almost switch into comedy. Sometimes it's horror. But, again, you get these consistent details, and the weird eyes is one of those details. Oftentimes they have oriental eyes. I know of cases, or a case, where the person described talking to this man with kind of bug eyes, and as he talked, his eyes seemed to extend 2 inches out of the socket. The weird eyes is a continuing detail.
I would not like that. Why do you think, Jim, that a subject that you have written seriously about, and that I am now amazed with, you know, I said people who have actually seen a Man in Black call, and were flooded with calls, serious calls, people who are not laughing, and they have produced a motion picture now, that is a comedy called Men in Black. Why do you think they would choose this time, that subject, to do a comedy?
You know, I don't really want to slip over into paranoia and say it's a big cover-up. And so my tendency is to say that, well, it was taken from a comic book. In fact, this Men in Black movie started out as a comic book. And I think they were just playing quite loose with the idea of Men in Black and perhaps really didn't know anything about the Men in Black. Now, if they had made, let's say, a case for government mind control operations, or a case for a government cover-up, perhaps it would have been a little bit harder to obtain the financing. But as to whether anything sinister shaped the film to begin with, probably not.
Okay. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Jim Keith. Good morning.
Good morning, Art. Good morning, Jim.
Where are you, ma'am?
My name's Roxanne, and I'm in Napa County, and I actually faxed you this because I wasn't sure I'd be able to get on tonight.
All right.
But I'd rather.
Oh, I've got your fax in my hand.
Okay. I wasn't even sure that was the right number.
No, you made it. It says, Art, this happened.
Yes.
Uh-huh. All right. Why don't you go ahead and tell the story, because I was prepared to read it on the air, but I'd rather hear it from you.
Okay. Let me tell you, too, that my heart's beating fast whenever I repeat this story. I've told very few people in my lifetime because I know what the reaction would be. And then when I did, I'm 41 now, and when I told someone who I thought was an intellectual about this a couple of years ago, they tried to justify it as being an act of child molestation that I didn't want to remember, so I was creating the Men in Black. But what it is this. I was about 6. My sister was almost 9 years old, and we were playing in the backyard. We lived in this big Dutch colonial house, 2-story in San Francisco, and my mother was from England. She had an English accent. My sister and I were in the backyard playing, and I had a favorite tree that I would climb. It had a smooth spot for me sitting in it so much. And I would climb up there and just with my thoughts, and sometimes just talk out loud to the tree. I even named the tree. So I was up there, and my sister was picking flowers. She was more of a lady. I was more of a tomboy. And then I sort of lost track of what she was doing because I was swinging on the tree. It was pretty high, well, for a kid. And then I could barely hear my mom's voice coming from the patio outside of the backyard. This is a huge house we're talking about.
Right.
And I heard my mom saying that, you know, calling out, Roxanne, Denise, dinner time. And so I sort of started running for the back door, and I said, I'll get Denise. And I ran back to tell Denise that it was dinner time, and she wasn't in the backyard anymore. And so I thought, well, maybe she wants to do something naughty. We're not supposed to go over that fence because there's an empty lot behind it, and it was kitty corner. I guess that's what you would call it, because the house next door was really, really over our backyard fence, so the next house over was an empty lot. I mean, the next space over was an empty lot full of grass. When I jumped up on the fence, I was standing on a 2x4 and stretching with all my might to see over it, to see if she'd gone over there.
Yes.
Because we were afraid of snakes and such. My sister was laying down, and 2 men were there, and one was bent all the way down on his knees, and my sister's head was just limp in his lap. My sister was laying down, and she was not conscious. She was not awake. And the other man was bent down over her with a syringe. And when I have told the story, I leave out the syringe because I think people are going to think I'm nuts if I go that far.
No, give it to us straight.
Okay. The man had a syringe and he held it to my sister's arm and I was literally shocked into silence at first because I could not believe what I was seeing because of the way they were dressed. They were dressed in black pants. These men weren't wearing black jackets. They were wearing black capes, which I've also changed into my story and I say jacket. They were capes. They had Zorro-type hats, which I later learned because when I got older, I saw Zorro. Now, when he was about to give my sister the injection, I screamed her name as loud as I could. And then I thought I should go get my mother because they wouldn't leave her alone, and I was screaming. I'm going, leave my sister alone, and then I started crying. And then I slipped off the fence, and I got a million slivers in my palm, which, you know, I didn't even feel at the time, and started running for my mother, but I fell down in the flower bed, a brick flower bed that we had. And then my instincts told me to save my sister because my instincts told me I didn't have time to get my mother.
Right.
So I jumped up on that fence, and I'd never been able to get that high before. And then the men were gone. My sister was waking up, and I asked her, Denise, what were they doing to you, and why, and who were they? And I'm freaking out, and I'm, you know, just a six-year-old kid. And she said, what are you talking about? And she said, what's the matter with you? You look scared to death. You're all white. And I said, and I told her what had happened to her, and she said, oh, brother. And she started climbing over the fence, and she started coming with me, and she was groggy, very tired, as if she'd just woken up. And then I went in the house. I didn't tell my mother, because she would have been scared to death, but I did tell my father. My father believed me. My father always believes all of us. There's seven kids in my family. And I want to know something. You know, I know damn well this was not something I created in my head as a cover-up for my seeing my sister molested. Because I know what molestation is.
Yes.
So what was going on? I never forget this. I can still see it to this day. I can see the color of the grass.
It's obvious from the way you tell it. There's no doubt about that. Jim, is that one you've never heard?
What I was going to say is that her account is very credible to me because of the wealth of detail. When people are making up stories, they usually don't inject that kind of detail. But no, that is not one that I've heard. But there are some truly remarkable details, and that's the thing about the Men in Black, is the details are often varied. You know what I'm reminded of with her story is this is the kind of stuff that's really been going on forever. And for instance, back in the 1600s, I've got a quote here. It says,
I'll tell you what, hold that quote for after the top of the hour. We can obviously keep on trucking here. Boy, I never had any idea we'd get so many stories like this. Holy mackerel. Sounds like to me you should write another book. Hang tight, Jim. We'll be back. We will be back. This is CBC. You've got to see it. You wouldn't want to meet it, but you've got to see it. It's on my website now. It looks like a creature of some kind. My website is www.artbell.com. Take a look. Let me know. Art, what if the Men in Black are the time travelers we never hear about? They would certainly have the technology to perform these feats that they're credited with, as well as what better way to know what events would have the greatest impact and would require some sort of intervention. Just think about it. The earliest reports are from the 1500s, and there is a consistency in their reported behavior. Now, the man who wrote the book on the Men in Black, the real book, the serious book, is Jim Keith, and he's my guest. Jim, how do people get your book?
Well, the simplest way would be to make a phone call, and that is to order Casebook on the Men in Black. It costs $14.95. Call 1-800-680-INET, I-N-E-T. That is 1-800-680-4638.
You're a fast study. Good. All right. Men in Black. Wild Card Line, you're on the air with Jim Keith. Good evening.
Morning. Hello.
Whatever. Where are you?
My name is Steve. I'm calling from Portland.
Yes, Steve.
Yes, and my grandmother used to scare us. I grew up on a ranch in Colorado. Used to scare us with a story about the Men in Black that came when her grandfather died. And You'll have to excuse me, I'm a little bit nervous.
It's quite all right.
But her grandfather was belonged to a benevolent order, not the Masons, but another, not very large, but still a significant benevolent order. I don't really want to mention that.
Okay.
But when he died, he always paid his dues, and my grandmother said they dressed him up like Dracula. He had a little sash around his neck, and he had this brooch. He worked in magnetics, and one of his hobbies was learning how to use hypnotism and magnetics to heal people.
Yes.
And when he died, after the ceremony, the graveside ceremony, they ushered the family away, and she said that the men in black came and they took the brooch from him, and they also he gave his papers to them before he died on what he was working about.
Are you you're saying brooch? Are you? Do you mean brooch?
Brooch, yes.
Brooch, all right.
Yeah, I'm sorry. My grandmother called it a brooch.
That's quite all right.
And she said that it was that his grandfather had joked that if you stared into it, it would steal your soul. And in order to keep us in line, she would scare us and tell us that the men in black would come and snatch our souls if we didn't behave. And I was wondering if is that something that sounds like it has a ring of truth in it, or was that just a story?
I don't know. I mean, it sounds like you have a soul, so you must have behaved yourself.
Oh, yes.
All right. Is that myth you've heard, Jim?
You know, it relates to some things I've heard, which or speculated. I don't know if I heard them exactly, but one speculation is that the men in black do have connections to a cultic or secret society, or as he said, a benevolent a brotherhood. But there are connections to that. For instance, it's been suggested that at least some of the men in black are agents of the Vatican, and that they are trying to stop speculation and talk and so forth about supernatural occurrences that aren't of a Catholic sort.
I tell you, Catholicism and the Vatican, these are very, very strange, secretive things. I interview Malachi Martin. If you've heard the show, I'm sure you've heard me interview Malachi.
I'm familiar with Mr. Martin.
Uh-huh.
You know, there is a secret society, a secret Catholic society called the Knights of the Apocalypse that was founded in the late 1600s, and its whole purpose is to combat the Antichrist. Now, they may see UFOs as being agents of the Antichrist. So, indeed, this is another thread, this kind of secret society thread.
The Knights of the Apocalypse.
Exactly.
Wow. In my last interview with Father Martin, he's very well connected in the Vatican, as advised to popes. And there is a 7-mile labyrinth of secret material below the Vatican. Father Martin tells me that if I wish to contact him, because I'm going to Rome in October, and I've been sitting here contemplating ever since whether I really want to enter such a secret area be beneath the Vatican. I may or may not do it. Depends on how adventuresome I feel, but depends on how adventuresome I feel. Man,
actually, that labyrinth sounds like kicks.
My.
Actually, that labyrinth.
That's for real, Jim.
Yeah, I know. I edited a book several years ago called. No, I edited Crest, and one of the things I received from an anonymous benefactor was a lot of history of this planet starting in the Middle Ages again and coming right up to the present, the Middle Ages again. And a man who alleged himself to be to have had access to an archive, and to substantiate that, he put the imprint of a brooch that listed him as a member of the Franciscan order, and his it was a credential that he would use in the Vatican. And so, you know, I'm always one willing to give an advertisement for one of my books, Art.
I understand. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Jim Keith. Good morning, actually.
Good morning. My name is Cougar.
Good morning, actually.
Good morning. In Tigard, Oregon.
All right.
I have a couple questions. I was referred to by a person who thought that you could help me out. I've been looking for a long time to find someone who could help me get to a UFO group talk thing, to help them talk about what happened, or a hypnotist. But I was told a hypnotist costs a lot of money, and I don't have a lot of money. And I want to take, because I remember a lot of stuff consciously, but there's also a lot of stuff I know happens that I don't remember anything about it.
All right. Does any of it involve the Men in Black?
Yes, it does.
In what way?
Well, there was in the Tigard Woods and the railroad tracks, me and about three or four other people were living on the streets four summers ago, and we had tents. We had two tents, and we lived in the woods there, and we had some weird events happen for the past two, three nights. The first of all, it passed off as a humongous red, last orange ball of light hit diagonally, or had made of light out once it hit the ground, and everywhere, and it made no sound. And then, we decided to go back to sleep because we started seeing something bright, kind of make us wake up.
Sure.
And kind of make us woke up because I heard some footsteps to make us, leaves crunching and twigs snapping.
Yes.
So I woke up Tom. And he woke up, and I said, did you hear that? He said, no. I said, what are you hearing? He basically was awake, but he was asleep when he was talking to me.
I understand.
And he said, just go back to sleep. And then it happened again, and it got loud, and then it brushing against the tent.
And
the noise.
Yes.
The side brushed against the tent.
And why would you think this would be a Man in Black?
Well, no, this is the scene of it. This is the beginning.
All right, well, we don't have a lot of time. This would
scene of it.
This, be the Man
well,
in Black.
Well, you have to skip all that part. And the Tigard, we were tigered, where you could see the part, you could not even see through the mirror thing, it was like a mirror, glass for them to see through.
Yeah.
It was just like a reflection of you. It didn't show anything inside. It was all black. And it was painted black, had no markings. And it was painted black. There would be also people in black, and black, dark black short sunglasses and nice ties and everything, but all black. And they were taking pictures of the people who were involved, what happened. But I don't know how they know that happened, because the only people know is now you, my mom, and the people who it happened with, my brother.
All right. Well, I appreciate the story, Men in Black. he mentioned a mirror. Somebody sent me a message earlier in the day. This is totally unrelated. We're doing the accounts for the accident to the Mir space station. There's a sign up there somewhere that says objects, in the mirror, appear to be closer, maybe closer than they appear to be.
Hey, Art, how you doing?
Well, I'm alright.
Well, I listen to you religiously every night on my way home from work at 4 a.m. here in, Oklahoma. And, I've been waiting for this Men in Black episode.
Alright, well, here we are.
In 1984, I was, I guess, in third grade. I was eight. And, yeah, I'm a young one. We lived in White Sands, Miss Lange.
Right.
On the base.
Right.
My stepfather was a photographer for the Army there, and my mom worked in some place through high security. I really have no idea what she did in there. And, one day we were out cooking out in the backyard, and I had a tetherball thing out there, and I was beating the tetherball around, and my stepfather was cooking steaks. And if you know anything about White Sands, the houses are like right next to the mountain, and the mountain range is right there in the Rockies. And it was about 5:30 at night, 6:30 at night, something like that. It was right before dusk, and a couple hours before dusk, and during the summer. And a white light started from the left side of the mountains and ran towards the right side. I guess it went from south to north, and then stopped and shot into the middle of the mountains. On the Las Cruces side of the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
Well, our neighbors had even seen it, because everybody was cooking out that day. It was kind of one of those days. And my mom ran in and called the military police. And she came back saying that the person was kind of rude and really fast talking. She said they'd been flooded with calls about this. And that thousands of people from Las Cruces had even called in wondering about this, because there's always some kind of testing going on.
Massive sighting.
And they said, no, don't worry about it. You know, it's probably nothing. About an hour later, there's a mountain road. It's a mountain pass road. It goes right over the mountain.
Yes.
And it just leads all the way up and goes down the other side. We saw a caravan of trucks, a big flatbed truck, and little vans and things like that. Army, of course, coming from the base. It goes over the pass. And an hour after that, it came back with something on the flatbed truck under a cover. And you can see all of this from, you know, because it's a really small place, White Sands is.
Uh-huh.
Right, it's right next to the road and everything.
So they had it, whatever it was.
Yeah, whatever. I have no idea what it was. And then I was playing tetherball later that night, right before it got dark, and we had already eaten and everything. And I looked inside, and my mom and my dad were talking to a man in a black suit with a black tie. And this other guy was in an army suit.
Yeah.
He was in, I can't remember whether it was BDUs or whether it was dress greens. But I remember he was in, it reminded me of something out of like a 50s sci-fi movie. You know? And it was like an escort or something. And I just remember them sitting on the couch in our living room talking. And I could see him through the back window. And I was playing tetherball. It was like the big thing at my school. I didn't care. I was just playing tetherball. And I don't know. My mom was really freaked out about the light and everything. She always would talk to me. She was talking to me that whole night about it. And they came back out, and I was like, who are those people? And my mom's like, oh, some people I work with. And then she goes, she was talking about it, and she goes, that light was just another one of the war games that they're playing on the mountains. And which they do about every weekend.
So you're suggesting that was your experience, your family's experience with Men in Black?
Yeah. This light was not a war game. I'm sorry. I've seen war games. My dad was a military police.
I understand. Yeah. All right. Well, is that, again, that's fairly typical, I guess, Jim. When something unusual happens, a sighting, something that might be related to military, is clearly at White Sands, probably was related to some secret thing or another.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. They come around and visit you.
Yeah, and I do believe that, I believe there is something of an ultra-terrestrial nature in terms of flying saucers and in terms of aliens. I don't think there's any proof that it's extraterrestrial, but I think there is a paranormal aspect, as I keep repeating, like the Men in Black. But I also think the government has an interest in covering up the secret things that they're doing and covering up their advanced technology. And part of that is by putting out information that suggests that all UFOs are extraterrestrials, and having people think of these kind of exotic craft only in terms of bug-eyed aliens.
Well, again, if you wanted to silence somebody, you're not going to wear a loud sport coat and a striped tie and arrive in an orange car. Dark, black, silent, scary, that intimidates.
Right.
There's simply no question about it. What is your next book, Jim?
I'm working on a book about mind control right now. It's called Mind Control, World Control, and it deals specifically with long-term projects by the CIA, such as MKUltra,
yes,
involved in manipulating people and so forth, and really a history of mind control in this world, going back to early experiments around the turn of this century and up to the present, and trying to delve into what is true and what is falsification and rumor.
Yep, the difference between truth and myth. All right, hang tight. We'll be right back, Jim. For my comfort level, Jim, why are we getting so much response?
You know, I'm very impressed by the quality of response in terms of people who have called in, almost one for one.
Yeah.
They sound credible and spooky, and I'm very impressed as well. I mean, I'm surprised, and thinking about this, if a survey was done, there must be hundreds of thousands of stories about Men in Black, around the world. I mean, I personally had no idea that there were so many encounters.
I'm still trying to contemplate the Knights of the Apocalypse. Whew. All right, first-time caller line, you're on the air with Jim Keefe. Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Linda.
Hi, Linda.
I'm calling from Omaha, Nebraska.
Okay.
And this event happened in the first week of June of 1975. I was at my mother's house, and our first child was about 5 months old. My dad and my brother and my husband were all watching something on TV, and it was getting towards her bedtime, and she was getting fussy, and I wanted to go, so my future sister-in-law and I decided to walk out in the front yard with her for a while, try to keep her quiet and, you know, stuff. And as we were standing out in the front yard, my sister-in-law was the first one that noticed the light, and she said, look, now, where this was is in North Omaha, and the way airplanes come into North Omaha, they come in from the north and around to what's called Epley Airfield. And she says, look at that airplane, Linda. She says, doesn't that have odd-colored landing lights? And I looked at it, and it was an orange. They weren't white. They were orange. And I said, well, I don't think planes have orange landing lights.
Mm-hmm.
And it got over an area of a cemetery that was about a half a mile to a mile from my parents' house. And we stood there, and it stopped dead. It was round. It was circular. It stopped dead over the cemetery. I mean, straight over the cemetery, where the cemetery was. It turned several different colors. It turned from the orange to the blue, green.
Yes.
And then it turned an absolute blood red, and it looked like it settled into the cemetery.
Oh, man.
Judy and I stood there and watched this.
Yes.
Horrified. And we run back into the house and told everybody what we had seen. And my dad said, well, he said, let's go up and drive along the back side of the cemetery. Huh. The name of the street is State Street.
Yeah.
And he said, see if we can see anything up there. We drove up there, drove up and down, couldn't see anything. Went home. The next morning was like a Saturday morning. And my husband and I used to go over and have coffee and rolls with my parents on Saturday morning. We were over there. And my dad said, where did it look? Thing came down now, did you say? And I said, it looked like it was the highest point in the cemetery. And he said, why don't we just drive up there and look around? So my mother, my dad, I, my 21-year-old brother, and my husband, and my baby, and I went up there.
Careful.
And we got up to where we thought was the highest point in the
yes.
was the highest point in the cemetery, and for where we were, the place we were, we could see a straight shot to my parents' house.
Yes.
Okay?
Yes.
Everything was flat up there. It was like there was an intersection, like a crossroads-like place there.
Okay, we're running short on time.
Okay, anyway, we all got out of my father's car, and we had been there for maybe 30 seconds looking around. There was a fresh grave over to the side, and you know how they lay the flowers down on a grave?
Of course.
Okay, all these flowers were blown all over the place. All of a sudden, from nowhere, we had no idea from where, appears this car. And it's an old black car. My dad's dead now, but he said it was like maybe an old Packard or something like that, or Dodge or something.
Yes.
But it looked like it was absolutely brand new. This one guy, the guy that was the driver, just got out and stood by the car, and the other guy started coming around and came over and said, and I was trying, it seemed so surreal because I was trying to figure out where.
Hey, you gotta get it out, man. We've only got about 30 seconds.
Anyway, the guy asked us where, he said, what business do you have here? And my dad said, well, we were just looking around. And he said, if you have no further business here, leave immediately.
Were these men in black?
Well, I'll tell you how they were dressed.
Were they in black?
No, they were not in black. They had World War II clothes on, is what my dad was.
All right, well, then what you saw was probably a ghost.
A ghost?
Yep.
Two
of them.
Great.
With sunglasses.
Well, okay, it sounds like Men in Black, but you say they weren't dressed in black, right?
No, they were not dressed in black, but their air of authority to leave
was
that area immediately.
I
and
understand.
Since then, we've gone up there, and that area did not look like it did then.
All right. Well, I appreciate the story. I'm not sure that's exactly a Men in Black story.
You know, actually, among researchers, these days, these guys don't really have to have gothic taste in clothing and to always wear black, because oftentimes, you know, the details vary, but in all of the trappings, it sounds like a Men in Black story, except that they had on gray clothing.
Exactly right. As I listened, I mean, graveyard, blood red, object, strange guys dressed in World War II type clothing, that sounds like a ghost story to me.
Did you hear the reference to the crossroads?
I did, yes.
Yeah. A lot of manifestations take place at crossroads.
Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Jim Keith. Hi.
Yes, sir. I'd like to ask your guest a question.
All right.
About the Mothman.
Yes.
That appeared, that was seen in southern Ohio along the Ohio River.
Yes.
This was back about 63, 64. I was living there at the time. I grew up there. And I'd like to ask him if there is any connection between the bridge that collapsed across the Ohio River at the time. There's a lot of people that live back there when I was there who think that it had something to do with the UFOs and the Mothman they were seeing at the time. And also I understand that there were some prophecies about that bridge collapsing.
Mothman prophecies.
Right.
Jim?
Yeah, in fact, John Keel, the main researcher who worked on the Mothman case, was in touch with a channeled entity named Apal, who predicted that there was going to be a catastrophe in that area. He said something about a water processing plant blowing up or something. I don't remember the exact details, that was going to take place on a certain date. In fact, on that date, the Silver Bridge collapsed. I believe 68 people were killed. The interesting thing that I find about that, aside from this prescience, this knowing that it was going to happen, is that just before the Silver Bridge collapsed, Men in Black showed up in the town of Point Pleasant, a large number of them, and people were seen crawling around on the bridge in the days prior to the collapse. I don't necessarily see that as a paranormal occurrence. The Mothman flap is truly an interesting case.
All right. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Jim Keith and Art Bell. Hi.
Yes, I had a strange situation happen back in 1985.
Where are you, sir?
I'm in Upper New York right now. My name's Dave.
Okay, Dave.
Back then I used to live in Pennsylvania, Latrobe, Pennsylvania. And I went to a gathering. Friends of mine had a little party, and we hit it up pretty good. And came time to go to bed, and I went to bed about, I don't know, it was probably 8 o'clock at night. And something woke me up out of my sleep around midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning. And when I opened my eyes, there was, at the time, it was kind of scary, you know, because I was only 18 years old then. There was somebody standing over top of me, which I thought was somebody. And it was like a split-second thing. He was there, and then he was gone. And what I saw was, you know, he reached out to me, and when I realized what was going on, like a split second, I realized what was going on, he was gone. And the next morning, I explained to everybody what happened, and they all were like, yeah, yeah, whatever. They didn't believe me.
Right.
Well, when I ended up going home to my parents' house, something, you know, I was into weightlifting and wrestling and all that, and I weighed myself, and I was 20 pounds less than what I was the night before. I weighed 20 pounds less.
My, my.
And I'd explained this to doctors, and I explained this to different people trying to explain how that happened. And everybody, like, yeah, yeah, we don't believe you. And the doctors couldn't explain it.
Anything resembling a man in black?
Yeah, the person had like a black tuxedo top on, like an overcoat with a long sleeve and a long tail.
Here we go.
Yeah. And when he reached out to me, I was so startled that, you know, I sort of, like, jumped up, and when I looked around again, he was gone.
Well, it's a good thing there's not a lot of those guys around, or Kaito Slim would be out of business.
I couldn't explain it. I had another thing happen to me. I was just wondering. I heard the other guy talking about the flatbed.
Yeah.
And he saw something on a flatbed.
I've seen plenty of those, too.
Yeah, I drive truck to trailer now, and I was down in Georgia on a backcountry road. I decided not to take the interstate, and I passed a flatbed who had something on the bed that was marked with placards that said U.S. government property.
Yeah.
And I was in the Air Force for 6 years, and I know what planes look like. I've seen some of the secret planes, and this thing had no cockpit, no jet propulsion on the back of it, and they had like a cable all the way around it saying U.S. government property.
Yep. Well, I appreciate the story. I've seen a lot like that. And the characters that you see driving, accompanying these vehicles many times are what you might describe as men in black. I've seen that. I've seen that here in Nevada. They drive all kinds of things around on our highways that you can barely imagine and probably don't want to know about. All right, West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Jim Keith. Hi.
Good morning, Art. Good morning, Jim. Thanks for taking my call. This is Richard in San Jose, California.
Yes.
And I had a situation back in the late 70s. I worked for an electronics company, and I was in shipping and receiving, and I was taking inventory. I was standing on one of these pallets. You know where a pallet is.
Sure.
And I fell through it, and I fell sideways and broke my ankle, and I'm stuck there. And I looked up, and I saw these two guys in black standing there. One was short, and it looked like they were taking inventory on me. I was wondering why I'm yelling, and why aren't you helping me? You know, why aren't these guys helping me? And they were standing. It was like a dream. I couldn't see any faces, but I saw they were in black. And next thing I knew, this little guy came running over, one of the guys that worked with me. And I'm a big guy. I was about 270 pounds. 6'2", and lifted me right up, and my ankle was broke, and it was, you know, just dangling, but these guys were gone, and I heard Jim talk about earlier the trauma. This was definitely a trauma thing, you know, but I definitely saw these guys, so that was my...
That's your Men in Black story, huh?
Yeah.
Yep. All right, I appreciate it. Before we let you get away, Jim, I have been instructed to ask you not to let you go without asking you about your work on something called Alternative 3, also known as Project Noah's Ark.
Mm-hmm.
Something about Jimmy Carter. What's all that?
Well, Jimmy Carter, what I reference in my book, Casebook on Alternative 3, I like the word casebook, apparently. Carter saw a UFO, and... the way that tees in is that Alternative 3 was a hoax done on British TV in the mid-1970s. It's widely believed to be true, you know, by UFO busts and so forth, but it was about a secret program of the elite to escape a dying Earth. And again, initially I thought this subject was just pure bunkum, but as I dug into this, I found that although there may not have been this specific Alternative 3 program, that every aspect of the program existed in one form or another. And so my Alternative 3 book, in a way, is a kind of an index to conspiracy, like secret space testing, government-built UFOs, mind control experiments, murdered scientists, that all happened to be put together in what was admittedly a hoax by the authors. It doesn't have a darn thing to do with Men in Black, but there it is.
How many books have you written?
Well, I've written quite a few. I have 7 out right now, but I think I've got 3 more in the pipeline. It's hard for me to keep track, but you know, I'm very fast in terms of my writing. And before I got into writing about UFOs and conspiracy, I wrote a lot of horror and science fiction, and so I've really got to the point where I can knock those books out. I've got 7 out.
All right, the one we've been talking about tonight is Casebook, you said you like that word, on the Men in Black. And that just really involves gathering the stories together. And your conclusion after doing that with this book was there really is, and obviously, listening on the phones for these hours, there is something to this whole Men in Black business.
Yeah, I think you're tracking with essentially the same experience I had. When I first came into it, it seemed like the subject was almost laughable.
Yeah.
And I had really intended to do a debunking of the subject in the sense of saying, yeah, sure, the government does these Men in Black things, but the rest of this is hoax and delusion. But after going through hundreds of these cases,
exactly.
I found that I was convinced there were so many credible cases that are impossible. And I came to the conclusion that to grasp the truth about the Men in Black, you had to deal with the impossible.
So in other words, you went into it, even though you had a prejudice, you came out on the other end, concluding there really is something to all of this. And I, in all the years I've been doing talk radio, you hear occasionally about the Men in Black. Only occasionally. But the minute you actually open the lines, it's like right now, they're just blazing away. I mean, all these people have seen Men in Black. It's incredible. Why is there not, other than the popular comedy movie right now, and your book, why have we not heard more about it in popular literature?
I think it's very hard to wrap your wits around the Men in Black and to really come up with an explanation for it. Like I said, in order for me to do so, I had to take a number of factors into consideration. I had to make that cut to say, yeah, a lot of these cases sound like a government operation.
Yeah, but this hasn't stopped people from writing about UFOs, a similar difficult subject to broach in any forum. They do lots of that, but not lots of Men in Black, and yet there's lots of Men in Black stories.
Well, you know, maybe if gray aliens wore top hats, we'd hear less about them. It would render it more incredible, and these stories are incredible, and you really don't expect to see a guy in a black cape, in your yard these days, much less to have him disappear. It's incredible.
All right. Well, let's do it one more time. We're at the end of the hour, and I really appreciate your having come on the air, because this is another one of the... I love doing topics, Jim, that nobody else will do.
Fantastic. I enjoyed myself greatly.
So to get a copy of Men in Black, it's $14.00. How many?
$14.95. And you call 1-800-680-INET. That is 1-800-680-4638. And if you buy a copy of the book, the publisher will throw in a copy of their great catalog as well.
All right. Done deal. Jim, thank you.
Lovely to meet you, Art.
Take care. That, my friend, is Jim Keith. And casebook on the Men in Black. All right. Well, ahead we've got nothing but open lines, unscreened talk radio. Anything you want to talk about, fair game. My book, The Quickening, is now in absolute general release. You ought to be able to find it about anywhere. Barnes & Noble bookstores would be a good place. Bookstop, B. Dalton, Borders Books, Music Stores, Walden's Books, wherever. You can find now The Quickening in general release. So pick your favorite bookstore and go in and get it. I think you will find it contains great proof of that which I've been discussing and talking about for years now. I'm Art Bell, and this is CBC. The British scientists who cloned Dolly the sheep said on Thursday they've made another, what they call, major advance by cloning Polly the lamb, who carries human genes. They showed a picture of Polly, the lamb, with the human genes on CNN. Polly has a pretty bizarre-looking face. It's a lamb, but it's not quite a lamb. Polly and four nearly identical sisters are transgenic. Transgenic. They are sheep carrying a human gene. Claimed the scientist managing director of Therapeutics, the company that did this, quote, "It was what we told everybody we were going to do, but it's nice to be able to say that we've done it," end quote. Well, I don't know whether it's nice or not. I'm beginning to get a little concerned that all of this genetic research is going to reach a mass critical point. I mean, this is the stuff they're doing in public. What the hell do you think they're doing in private? Well, that leads me to story number two. The following I have not concocted. It is from Reuters in London. Gene therapy could be twisted into terrifying genetic weapons that target and destroy ethnic groups. British doctors warned on Tuesday. The British Medical Association, remember this is Reuters, the British Medical Association is so worried by the possibility that it has commissioned a team of geneticists, biologists, lawyers, and warfare experts to see if the technology is possible, and if so, to ban it now. It is, said the doctor, Dr. Viveni, I believe it is, a particularly horrifying thought. If you were a dictator somewhere in the world, and you wanted to get rid of a group of people in your population who opposed you, whether you're talking about the Hutus, the Tutsis in Rwanda, Bosnian Serbs, or 1930s Germany, you could use this. So in other words, they simply let something loose that goes tearing through a particular ethnic group, kick them cleanly and quickly. Anybody out there really want to try and argue with my concept of the quickening? Raise your hands, please. Anybody want to argue with that? I have documented in my book exactly what I just talked about. This really is a book that you should have, so I will use this as an opportunity to plug my book. It's in bookstores now nationally, so you don't have to call a number. You can still do that, by the way, but the easier way to do it now is simply to go into a bookstore and ask for the quickening. And that's what I suggest you do. God, we're getting in frightening times, aren't we? On the lighter side, as I tried to say earlier, and I didn't say it right, to quote some email I got, engineers from NASA, and finally, don't forget Richard Hoagland speaking at NASA tomorrow night. Engineers at NASA have finally determined the cause for the accident which placed the Russian space station and its resident personnel in jeopardy. In a statement released Thursday, a spokesperson for the agency said, "Our investigation has revealed that the collision between the Russian space station and the resupply rocket was caused by one thing and one thing only. Objects in Mir are closer than they appear." Resist that. And then there is this. Two more weirdo items. This guy wakes up one morning to find a gorilla in his backyard tree. Imagine that, finding a gorilla in your backyard tree. Anyway, he gets his phone book and looks up the gorilla removal service in the yellow pages. The gorilla service guy says he can help him out, but he needs to know if it's a male or female gorilla. So the man runs outside, leaving the phone off the hook, checks it out, and tells the gorilla service guy it's a male gorilla. Service guy says, "Okay, I'll be right over." A short time later, the service guy shows up with a stick, a chihuahua, a shotgun, and a pair of handcuffs. He gives the man some instructions. Now he tells the man, "I'm going to climb the tree, and I'm going to poke this gorilla with a stick until he falls. When he does, the trained chihuahua will attack the gorilla's genitals. The gorilla will then reach for his genitals to protect himself naturally, and that's when you snap the handcuffs on him." Man says, "Okay, well, what am I supposed to do with the shotgun?" Service guy replies, If I fall out of the tree before the gorilla, shoot the chihuahua. Saving these up. 10 today's breaking news from the Associated Press. 3 Yemeni men claim ownership of Mars and have actually filed a lawsuit against NASA for landing on the red planet. And I have their names here, and I wouldn't even begin to try to pronounce them. These 3 men have filed documents in a Yemeni court that they say prove their claim that they own Mars. They said, quote, we inherited the planet from our ancestors 3,000 years ago. And they are very upset that NASA's Pathfinder spacecraft landed on Mars, their property, July 4th. Now, while I've seen a lot of photographs of Mars, panoramic views, I've not yet seen anything resembling a Yemeni no trespassing sign. Nevertheless, they're upset that Sojourner and Pathfinder began exploring Mars without informing them or even seeking their approval. One has to wonder if the plaintiff's case is granted, what NASA is going to be able to do to satisfy the verdict. As for comment, Richard Cook, Pathfinder mission manager at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory at Pasadena, said, Mars is everybody's. It's for the whole world to explore and understand. Do you think that is a sufficient defense? West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello.
Hey, how you doing, Art Bell? Well, I have to credit the Men in Black stories were excellent.
Well, as I said earlier, I enjoy doing things that other talk show hosts would not dream of doing. So,
and it goes into the mythical and old-time legends that we've had throughout the centuries. I think the Men in Black has been with us since maybe 2,000-3,000 years ago, since recorded history.
He thought 1,500.
1,500, yes. I think they've been with us a very long time in mythology.
Hundreds of years, at least.
And what I would like to discuss is a previous show, you had a gentleman who was going to go into this electric field, 3 million milliwatt electric field.
No. 3 million volts. A Jacob's Ladder improved, actually. Madman Markham. Madman Markham has not been heard from. He is either by now a total French fry, or he is some time else.
And what I would like to know, is there any videotape of the event, any witnesses, any follow-up stories?
No, and he was supposed to call me and tell me when he was going to scroll through. So.
And has anybody looked for him?
It's a good question, and I don't have an answer. I have looked for him, and I've got the word out, and I'm trying to find out what's going on with Madman, but right now, he's as much of a mystery as the Men in Black.
Well, I hope somebody finds him, and I hope that, at least a follow-up story would be great on your show.
Well, right, but I mean, if the guy has gone through, he's either dust or he's somewhere else some other time. And if he's in another time, then, try and imagine the best. Try and imagine he's back in 1855, having fun. I can't tell you. I have no answer. And when I do, it'll be on the air. East of the Rockies, you're on the air.
Yeah, Art, it's Vince in Chicago.
Hey, Vince.
The part about the Men in Black where your guest said that... the Knights of the Apocalypse are working for the Vatican?
Oh, yeah.
I found that really kind of intriguing. What do you think about that?
Well, it made me wonder whether I want to take up this invitation to be able to stroll through the labyrinth 7 miles under the Vatican in the dark catacombs of secrecy.
Yeah,
and I actually have an invitation to do that. Would you do it?
I think I would. Like you say, you only live once. I would do it. And I know if Malcolm Martin asked you... if you wanted to do that, he would arrange it.
Yeah.
I would take him up on that.
This is going to be a very, very, very interesting trip.
Did you ever hear the Knights of the Apocalypse? I never did.
No, but somehow, one can absolutely imagine that there is such a group. I don't know if they'd call themselves the Knights of the Apocalypse. It's certainly a pretty horrifying name. But, I mean, sure, the church absolutely believes the Antichrist is coming. And I am sure that they have very special groups that are following leads looking for exactly that occurrence. Of course, I believe it, yes.
And I have a feeling something's up too, whether it's the quickening or whatever. Something's up with the whole alien phenomena that we are experiencing nowadays.
Well, even if you forget that, even if you forget the things that we can't quite explain, like Men in Black and all the rest of it, and look at what they're doing right now with genetics, it's beginning to scare the hell out of me.
It really, that story about the sheep with the human gene, that is really scary.
Yeah, they showed the sheep. You'll see it later today on CNN. Look very carefully at that sheep's face. It has subtle human characteristics, and it's eerie.
It sounds very eerie. All right, how about Phoenix? Has anything happened in Phoenix yet?
Well, we'll get a full report tomorrow night. That's why Mr. Hoagland's going to be here.
I'm looking forward to hearing that. Mr. Hoagland's one of my favorite guests on your program. He's always very interesting and should be a good show.
All right. Well, I will strangle him until he comes to the point, just as a favor for all of you and my own sanity. Richard knows this of himself. So we've got an awful lot of material to cover tomorrow night, and I'm not going to allow Richard to drag each one out until the point where I'm ready to explode. Now, I realize that you've got to lay groundwork for a lot of what you say. And he promised yesterday when I spoke with him that, in fact, because we have laid so much groundwork already, that we will be coming to the point very quickly with very many things. And it's not just Richard tomorrow night, but he's bringing a lot of expert support for what he's got to say. So we'll see. We'll be going into, but not completing, the 26th. And you recall Richard said that he expected something between the 20th and the 26th. If you want to know what I think we got it. If you recall, the Pathfinder and Sojourner they lost contact on, of all days, the 20th. NASA lost contact with them. There were several things that NASA did that are simply unbelievable, absolutely unbelievable, on the 20th. And that's a little too much coincidence for me. Richard will lay it out tomorrow night. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hi.
Hello, this is Lathan.
Lathan, where are you?
I am in Tigard.
Okay. Did you call earlier?
No. I actually know the guy, but...
You know the guy. Well, turn your radio off.
Okay.
That's number one.
What I wanted to know about is if the planets aligning and everything would have to do with that.
To do with what?
Well, I mean, the supernatural and...
Yes, when they align, we are all going to wink out.
Okay, well,
like that.
I don't think it'll be happening just like that.
Yes, it will, just like that.
I think it'll also have to do something with a lot of the occurrences with UFO sightings.
No, you're going to wink out. Gone.
Okay.
Dust.
I was also noticing a lot of similarities between the UN and the seven-headed beast in the Bible.
Seven-headed beast in the Bible?
Yes.
And you equate that to the United Nations?
Yes, I do, because in the Bible it says that there is a seven-headed beast that has 10 crowns, and it will basically rule over the world for a while.
Yeah.
And there's seven major nations in the UN, okay, with hundreds of other nations backing it up, which describes the body of a leopard.
Yeah.
Okay. And one of the nations has two crowns, like the U.S.
You're beginning to scare me. Why are you talking this way to me?
I don't know.
Well, I can't take much more. Seven-headed beasts of the UN. It's all too much for me. Thank you for the call, and goodbye. I got a fax from somebody earlier today named Dean, who writes the following question, Art. I cannot believe the police would block off an 18-block area just because one man, Kunin, shot himself. Is this common practice? Was more than one shot fired? Was there a shootout between Kunin and the police? Did the police want him dead because he knew too much? He was a member of a very big, high society, gay group from Las Vegas to San Diego to Miami, Chicago, etc. I've got to admit that the whole thing and the way it went down was pretty strange. I have yet to understand why they initially reported they found no body in two searches and found a body on a bed in a third search. I don't buy it. Then later they corrected it and said, no, we found a body in the first search. Now, in my mind, that's a little like first saying it was a flying saucer that crashed and then saying it was a weather balloon. So there's a number of things about this whole business with Kunin that I don't understand. Other than that, it seems to me it's pretty much case closed. The gun that he is said to have killed himself with, you know, eaten, was the gun used to kill the fashion designer. Same gun. So that would seem case closed. But there's a lot of strange things going on with the way the police handled this, and I'm not comfortable with it. East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hi.
Yeah, the amazing thing about that Kunin case, good morning, Art, is the fact 30 hours after he actually was found or whatever, they're still continuing to run it as the lead story at the top of every hour.
I know it. I know something, there's something going on here that I'm not sure of yet.
Media really did not want the story to end this way, I don't believe.
No, they probably wanted a big trial.
Right.
You know, they probably wanted a big trial. So, but still, it came down very oddly, don't you think?
Oh, incredibly. And it's told, like you said a moment ago, it still hasn't been explained what happened in the first couple of hours after the standoff was in the, you know, the 18 blocks.
I mean, I was watching it on CNN, and I heard the reports as they came in. When it's breaking news, I sit down and park myself in front of breaking news.
Sure. Unfortunately, I was asleep at that time preparing for your show, but go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I'm sucked into it.
Go ahead.
The breaking news, everything around the house stops. We all sit down. We watch whatever's going on. I'm a junkie.
Of course.
For news. But, so anyway, the whole thing was strange.
Absolutely.
Well, we'll see.
Okay.
Well, probably, in truth, we'll never know. It's another one of those things we'll never know. Like the Kennedy assassination, we'll never know. We'll hear stories. Tonight, we even heard stories about the men in black involved in the Kennedy assassination. Why not? Everything else has been. And this, everything else, strange stuff, and we'll never know the whole story. Somebody ought to write a book. Well, I guess you couldn't write a book about these things, could you? Or maybe you could collect and write a book about things that we will never... And write a book about... West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello.
Well, good morning, Art.
Good morning.
I haven't talked to you since KDWN days.
My God.
It's been a while.
Time.
Yeah, well, I wanted to comment on this Kunin mess. I don't think it's really that strange. I mean, you know, his actions, of course, are very strange, very sad.
Well, of course. Horrible. But the way the police handled it is odd.
Well,
the way it came down.
They were, you know, the cops, you know, there's a lot of ego was on the line. Here this guy was on the loose for months, leaving calling cards, hey, here I am, here I was, you idiot, calling cards, hey, you couldn't even get me.
I know, then in the very end, they really didn't. All they got was a body. I wonder if they were bummed.
What I heard was they're pretty damn happy about what happened, because they did not want a trial. They just, you know, more publicity, you know, more of him grandstanding and whatever. I mean, you know, to me, he just, you know, at the end of it, you know, he was, oh, that's it, man. I killed four people.
Yep.
I got no money. My friends are all turning against me. A few friends I got left. Oh, the hell with it.
I hear you. I'm sure you're exactly right.
He laid on that bed and he just blew his brains out.
I hear you. But maybe they're in some ways disappointed there wasn't some shootout.
Well, I don't know. Yeah, well, those Miami cops are known to be pretty quick, you know, trigger, you know. But you remember those riots they had down there a couple of years ago?
Yep.
Yeah, the Cubans and blacks and everything, but I don't know. I think it, you know, I really feel really bad for the families. I just, you know, that it's just
always,
so, it's so sad, you know.
Always. And the only reason I wish, I guess, that they had captured him alive is so that we could understand why he did what he did.
One more thing, Art. A very strange occurrence happened at the Senate hearings today, or yesterday. You know, this, you know, finances, you know, campaign finances. We had a witness who didn't want to plead the Fifth. He didn't have to be subpoenaed. He didn't run away from the country. And for some reason, he said, okay, here I am. Take your best shot at me.
Yeah.
And the Democrats were absolutely, didn't know what to do. They were, I mean, they were shooting blanks all over the place. And that was pretty amazing. I think,
well, I don't
think. And John Glenn. What happened to my hero?
I don't know. Look, to me, the whole campaign finance thing is a damn joke on the left and the right. I mean, it's a joke. And that's why I don't talk about it a lot. Do you think they're going to really do anything about campaign finance reform? Ken, if you think that, I got a plot on Mars for you. And I don't care whether they sue me or not. In fact, I'll sell you a little piece over by the face, if you want it. Both sides of the aisle. Money is the mother's milk of politics. And mother's milk is the last thing they're going to give up. So I don't care what they talk about, what rule they pass, they're always going to find a way to get around it. And if they need $20 million to run for a Senate office, they're going to find it. The story. It's a bunch of story. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi, Art. This is Paul calling you from Phoenix, Arizona.
Hello, Paul.
Yeah, could I make a prediction for, like, the next 3 days?
No.
I can't?
No.
Why not?
No, you can't.
Oh, I'm just predicting, like, a heat wave that's going to go across to the west to the east. How about that?
Well, I would say you don't have your neck too far out. I mean, this is, what, August 25th or something now, right?
Yes, sir.
Uh-huh. So, I'm sorry, July 25th. So, we're dead middle of the summer.
Right.
Predicting a heat wave is not exactly sticking your neck way out.
One more thing, about that witch that, Evelyn was her name?
Evelyn Paglini, yes.
Yes. What I was curious about, the guy that you're looking for, do you know who he is? Or, like, the spell or whatever you're trying to put on him? Was that just going to, like, go out in outer space? Or what's the deal?
I really can't talk about it, but I appreciate the call. Thank you. East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello.
Hi, Art.
Hello.
This is, I'm going to use not a real name.
You're going to use a pseudonym?
A pseudonym. This is George in Miami.
George in Miami?
Yes.
All right.
I am a Miami police officer. That's the reason I'm using a pseudonym.
Okay.
And I am trying to disguise my voice, so hopefully I'm not recognized.
Well, you're doing the best you can, I know, but you really need one of these. Anyway.
Probably would help.
Go ahead.
This deal with,
Internet.
Yep.
Can you tell us anything we don't know?
I'm not going to divulge a lot. I am just going to say that the Miami Police Department was very disappointed that they didn't get him. The FBI was very disappointed that they didn't get him.
Well, I'm not surprised. I appreciate that inside information, but that's not a shock.
I know that, but you know, there was a lot of, you know, speculation. You kind of were saying, well, that's probably how they should use.
Yeah.
I'm telling you that is how they felt. They didn't. That is how they felt. They. This was talked about for a week. They didn't want him to take him. They wanted to. Didn't.
I don't doubt a word you're saying, and I appreciate your verifying what I thought.
Okay, all right. Have a good night.
Yes, sir. You too. Yeah, I think that guy was real. Sure. I absolutely buy into what you just said and what I think. It's a natural reaction for the police and the FBI who wanted to get their guy. They didn't want their guy to get himself. They wanted to get their guy. And I will even extend it beyond that. I'm disappointed in that reason that I would like to know his motivation. I mean, are we beginning to get more and more people, I refer to my quickening, thank you, and you'll find a chapter in the book on this, who just don't care about life. Life means nothing. I'm into pure speculation now. But Kunanan seemed to be taunting the police, always a bad idea, into catching him, saying, leaving clues, getting close, catch me, come on, get me, get me, get me. And there is a certain amount of ego involved in law enforcement, and they wanted to get his tail end. And I don't, and I think from society's point of view, we've got to begin to understand why you're getting these people who crave attention and murder to get it. He literally turned from whatever he was into a serial killer for attention. Took life without thinking about it to get attention. We need to be able to understand something about these people. So from that point of view, I think it was very disappointing that he was not taken alive. And as for the police, it is, and I understand their disappointment at not getting him one way or the other. It's a natural reaction. It's not a big secret. It was one of the biggest manhunts in all of history, and I'm sure they wanted to get their man. First time caller line, you're on the air. Hi.
Hello?
Turn your radio off, please.
Yes, I will.
Okay, please. Thank you. Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Am I speaking to Art Bell?
You are.
Oh, this is first time caller. I am from Vancouver, British Columbia.
Ah, okay.
And I discovered your program, in fact, only the beginning last week. And I'm very intrigued by it. But last night's program has completely, I don't know, confounded me. I am just, I couldn't sleep, I'll tell you honestly.
Colonel Corso.
Yeah.
Yes, I understand your reaction because by listening to a man who's 82 years old, with his background unquestioned, we know his background is accurate, saying what he said, you're forced to either believe what he said is absolutely true, which is mind-boggling, or you're forced to believe he's a liar, which in his case is very difficult.
I believe he's telling the truth.
Yeah, so do I.
And another question is this. I already ordered that book, and I can read in Vancouver from Banyan Books, but the quickening, I want so much to get, and I tried all big books to write, and no, I never heard of it, and it's not on the list, but it one from the Colonel Philip Corseau.
Yes.
They had on the list.
Well, his book has been out for some time now. Mine just went to the bookstores.
Yes.
So continue to check. They should have it on their computer list.
But he said not yet.
And if they don't, they will soon. Now, you're in Canada, so I'm not as sure about that. I will have to ask my publisher. It certainly is true in this country, and maybe Canada takes a little longer. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. But they have that. They have it on the list from the Colonel Corseau.
Yes, oh, I'm sure they would.
Yeah, but I've asked them anyway to try to get me two copies because somebody else is very interested too. So I really hope I can get that book.
I hear an accent in you. Where are you from?
From Holland.
I'm sorry?
From Holland.
Holland?
Yes.
Wonderful. Well, you call me again. Good luck on the book. It's a great read. You will really enjoy it.
Thank you very much for taking my call, too.
Okay. Take care. From Holland. East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello.
Hello, Art Bell.
Yes, sir.
Very interesting program tonight.
Yes.
They're talking about the black cats, the black dogs, and everything such as that.
Mm-hmm. I have two black cats.
Black cats at the house myself.
Mm-hmm.
Can I ask you something? What is the fear of the black cats and the number 13?
Well, it's all connected. I mean, the fear of black cats is that when one crosses your path, you'll probably be vaporized or something other, some other disagreeable thing will